Welcome to Unspeakable, the podcast of the Cthulhu Mythos gaming magazine, The Unspeakable Oath. The Unspeakable Oath is sponsored by...
the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival and CthulhuCon. That's Gwen and Brian, who you're going to hear from this episode, or have already heard from this episode, depending on where we splice this in. That's in Portland, Oregon, April 11th to 13th at www.hplfilmfestival.com. You've heard all about the guests and whatnot, so, you know, I don't think I have to spend any more time describing how awesome the film festival is going to be.
All right. We're also sponsored by Innsmouth Magazine. They're at innsmouthfreepress.com. And this month, they're raising funds until March 13th at Indiegogo for She Walks in Shadows, which is the first all-woman anthology of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft. The stories are about female characters from Lovecraft. Believe it or not, he actually had some here and there. But these stories are sort of all focused on them. Nictocris and Shub-Niggurath if you want to read a story about Lavinia Whatley, I'm sure that's going to be plenty horrifying.
I'm really looking forward to that collection. Our other sponsors include Necronomicon Providence at www.necronomicon-providence.com. Last year, I and Shane and the folks that's here have attended the Necronomicon convention in Providence, and it was a smashing success. And we can only hope that the 2015 upcoming scheduled Necronomicon Providence in 2015 will be even half as amazing. I myself plan to not run 24 hours of gaming, in 3 days. That's my goal. So I can actually get out and attend things and do things. And, you know, it was so much of that convention. I was not able to see as much as I wanted because I was so busy, inflicting horrible forms of death on some players. Shane, you only ran one game, two games?
No, I ran three. I was in exactly the same boat. I spent most of my waking hours running games.
Well, I'm doing two games tops. Yeah. That's it. It's in the morning.
Because there's an awful lot going on.
Yeah, I get out. I am done by three, and I am drinking and talking to writers and creators and fellow Lovecraftians. That's my plan.
It was such a shame because I was running a game when the Thickets started their concert. And so I wrapped up my game, and the game was fun. You know, no complaints. Everybody had a great time. And then I immediately, you know, went running to get to the concert, and I got lost trying to find
as the streets began to twist.
Yeah, exactly. It's Providence,
like Carcosa,
right? And so I finally got there, and by the time I got there, they were already really well into the concert. But I saw them playing, and then I think it was about 30 seconds or so, maybe one song into me being there and enjoying the show, when like the power got cut to a bunch of their amps because it turned out that like there were neighbors complaining because this is a residential area, you know, and it was late and they had kind of gone past their bedtime basically, and so so the last couple of songs was Torin and Warren and the guys kind of basically trying to get the, you know, getting the crowd to be their amplifiers, you know, for a performance of Nir Lothotep.
You can't stop the mythos.
Yeah. So yeah, it was the show was great fun. So I'm looking forward to next year. And then finally, Atlas Games is sponsoring the Oath as well, as they have since the very beginning. And Atlas, as you ought to know because you are listening to this podcast, and if you don't, then shame on you. They publish Cthulhu 500, Cults Across America, Clifford the Big Red God, Where the Deep Ones Are, Cthulhu Gloom, Unknown Armies, Over the Edge, Ars Magica, Once Upon a Time, and if you're still not sold, then there's something wrong with you.
The nephews are brilliant supporters of the Mythos.
If Dennis and I had not launched Arc Dream Publishing as our own little cottage thing, we would be pitching to John and Nephew with every new idea we have, because they're terrific. Or John and Michelle Nephew with every new
idea. That's John and Dr. Nephew.
I apologize, yeah. Michelle, sorry about that. Dr. Nephew. But they're terrific people, and their games and books are amazing, and they've been great supporters of the Oath, so go get them.
This is episode 10, hosted by me, Ross Payton, of Roleplaying Public Radio. And with me, as always, is Mr. Shane Ivey of Arc Dream Publishing and Scott Glancy of Pagan Publishing. And we have two guests today, Gwyn and Brian Callahan of the HP Lovecraft Film Festival on CthulhuCon. So, Scott, can you introduce our guests in a little more detail?
Well, I think you did a fabulous job fumbling your way through the introduction, and I don't see how I could possibly improve.
Now, let's remember, Ross, that is actually H.P. Lovecraft is the way you pronounce it.
H.P. Lovecraft, yes.
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of trouble pronouncing these, Lovecraftian things, and starting with his name. So we understand if you couldn't quite get it through your... your verbal architecture, since it was, designed only to pronounce terrestrial words.
Before we go any further, Brian and Gwen, do you guys want to bust Ross's balls over that for us a little bit?
I don't know. I think we'll let that one go.
Okay.
His balls are sufficiently busted already.
There'll be plenty more things to excoriate him about before the episode is over with. Gwen and Brian Callahan are recent... in geologic time, they are recent migrants to the Pacific Northwest, having come from the incredibly mythosy town of New Orleans, out to the considerably less mythosy town of Portland, Oregon. They came out to the festival. They started off as one of the merchants out there. I should say one of our, because I've never had any financial connection to the film festival. I just was a participant. But they stepped up to the plate and took over the northern end of the franchise when Andrew Migliori decided that he wanted crazy things like insurance for his child, not a regular paycheck, and went to work doing things where he could not spend 3 to 4 months preparing for a film festival, they seem to have transitioned very nicely to Northwest. Was it the hurricane? Was it Katrina that was the last straw for you guys, as far as New Orleans went?
I think it wasn't quite the last straw. It was sort of the beginning of the process for us, because we actually lived in New Orleans longer after the storm than we did before.
Oh.
But I think what we saw, that things didn't feel like they were sufficiently improving for us. The city was always, I hate to speak ill of it, but it always had a certain kind of third world vibe. And after the storm, that got even more pronounced. And,
yes, well, law enforcement is an entrepreneurial exercise. Yes, and, you can't get anyone to do anything to improve the city unless there's something in it for them, new streets. Well, how's that going to put a Cadillac in my driveway? That's New Orleans.
Well, and we also a certain amount, right after Katrina, it was a very growth oriented time, and everybody was psyched to be back in New Orleans and to be doing it and to be rebuilding. But that enthusiasm definitely faded after a while. And, one of the things we discovered after a couple more years is that every time hurricane season came around, we were filled with really some horrible dread about the whole thing, because we'd been through this horrible disaster.
And nothing had been done to fix the problem. I mean, if the levees gave away again...
The levees were no stronger afterwards than before.
Yeah. Yeah, well, storm of a lifetime, I can go ahead and not worry about it anymore. It's done.
That is part of the attitude.
Yep. Yeah, I used to live in New Orleans myself, and it was always a place that was teetering on the edge of an abyss. And having fallen into the abyss, their attitude seems to be, "Hey, this abyss isn't so bad. have another hurricane," and by which I mean the drink. I guess, what's more New Orleans, Hurricane Sazerac? What would be the appropriate drink to pass to your buddies after the apocalypse?
Well, I think a hurricane. A hurricane's a nice, simple drink.
Okay.
It's the people's drink.
unlike that,
what kind of people are you talking about?
Fruit punch and rum.
Oh, unlike that snooty mint julep? Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yes.
So since then, you've started running the film festival and CthulhuCon.
But let's not forget, they also run the Arkham Bazaar.
The Arkham Bazaar.
So never forget Arkham Bazaar. Mm-hmm.
But recently you just had a Kickstarter for the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival. Can you tell the listeners out there who aren't familiar with it, what kind of goals, what kind of what it was for exactly, and what the people who are going to the film festival can now expect?
Well, you know, one of the things when we started, I hate to use the word takeover because it wasn't a hostile takeover, but when we helped Andrew alleviate his stress by beginning to be the organizers for the festival.
That sounds like something out of The Sopranos. We helped him alleviate his stress into a ditch.
we didn't realize, I think what a lot of people don't realize, and that's just how just stupidly expensive it is to put on any kind of public event, you know.
You have to rent the venue.
Yeah.
You have to, there's certain films, like, I mean, most of our films are submitted to us, but then, of course, you want to show some classic studio films for reference and kind of give people a touchstone upon which to base their opinions about these other independent films. And then there's, you know, you got to fly out guests and put them up in hotels and pay for venues and advertising and all the upfront costs that cost a lot of money. We were basically doing on our credit cards, and that's just not a good way to do anything, really. So.
Yeah, in 2011 and 2012, we kind of bankrolled the show with our personal credit cards, and that was, you know, not disastrous, but certainly not ideal.
A bold strategy.
Yes, yeah, it's no, scary, nobody, is what it is.
Nobody likes paying 24% interest, or is that just me?
Right.
and you know, to say a show like this is expensive, you know, it's I've made, back in my younger days, I had a yearly salary that was less than it cost to put on the show. It's a very, very expensive endeavor, and the bigger you want, and you want something like this to grow, so every year it gets maybe a little more expensive. You know?
Yes, exactly.
So Kickstarter, that means great things then, right?
Yeah. The Kickstarter, last year was our first one, so for the 2013 festival. And man, that really helped take some of the upfront load off. We had a pretty modest goal. I think we had a $9,000 goal last year. And we ended up with...
16.
Almost 17. 16.7 or something like that.
Right.
And
which I'm sure does not cover the cost by any stretch of the imagination, but that's a heck of a load off.
Well, it helped take care of some of our biggest initial upfront costs. That's
right.
Things like renting the theater itself,
right.
which is itself a very big expense. Because we rent out, it's a beautiful, it's the Hollywood Theater here in Portland. It has three auditoriums, three separate screens, and it's a restored 1926 Prohibition-era theater. So it's really the perfect place to do this sort of thing.
Prohibition.
Mm-hmm. Although they're serving beer.
Oh, that's the best thing. That venue has gotten better and better over the years, where they finally knocked off. They had a pizza joint open up next door that has knocked a hole in the wall, so that now there's just this that one hallway that originally just went down to the bathroom. Suddenly there's just this little archway, this sort of half-door archway, where you can just wander up and order a pizza from next door and take it into the... Oh, it's nerd-friendly.
Yeah.
They call that the pie hole.
Wow!
Of course.
Not bad.
Wow. What else could they call it?
What kind of films are there any new, like, world premieres or any sort of really good...
What are you guys most excited about there this time?
Good way of putting it.
Well, we've got some good... we have a great independent world premiere called The Sunderland Experiment, which is... this is one of those films I don't want to talk about too much, because I, you know, with an independent film, there's really a chance you're going to go into it not knowing what's going to happen, and that's the perfect way to go into this film.
Yeah.
But there are some great mythos elements. It has a semi-post-apocalyptic feel, but it's because it involves a complex that's shut off from the rest of society, and that's probably all I should say about it. But it's really a wonderful film. It has some great mythos elements, and some great effects. And it's totally indie. You've never heard of this film. There's no way, probably, that you've seen it. Probably.
Yeah. I don't think it's anywhere. I don't think you can see it.
And this is, besides a friends and family showing that the filmmakers had, this is the world premiere.
Oh, wow. I'm excited.
I can't wait for people to see this movie, because I was blown away by it.
Is there even a trailer for it up online?
I think there is a trailer for it. Maybe.
Well, we'll have to link
to it. We'll try and see if we can link to that, just to whet people's appetite.
Exactly. We've been adding, as we add films to the hplfilmfestival.com website, if there are trailers available for those films, we try to include them in the descriptions.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'll double check later and see.
But then we're also doing that's a great film, and we love it when we get independent features that nobody has seen, because most of what we show are independent short films. Mm. Independent filmmakers, making a feature is also a very expensive proposition. So it's great when you get one that's actually well done and really good, that has great acting and good effects. And this is one of those movies.
And good editing.
Oh, wow.
Nice pacing.
God, yeah. That one of the things that always happens at the film festivals, you run across movies where somebody shot something and it looked cool, so they had to show it to you for 30 seconds.
They're darlings, right?
Yeah.
We set a guy on fire. You want to see it from every angle? You're going to see it from every angle.
This is 80% of our budget right here, so you're going to enjoy it.
It's going to be 80% of the movie. That's all there is to it. There's been a number of those where I'm just like, oh, yeah, every frame is a perfect snowflake.
Hey, man, Steven Seagal and Jean-Claude Van Damme films did it all the time in the 80s, and it worked for them, so it'll work for us. We're going to show you that backflip kick every angle. It'll be great.
So, Gwen and Brian, you can and Scott, you can all speak to this, but sort of describe what's the experience of the festival like? You get off the plane and you go downtown and start going to it. What's happening there? What's it like?
I was going to say that the drugs kicked in are somewhere around Tacoma. We can't stop here. It's backcountry. sadly, not enough of that. Go ahead, Brian. I mean, you guys came in from out of town originally as...
Well, for us, we were always vending. So it was kind of like we shipped a bunch of boxes here. My brother picked us up at the airport in his veggie oil van again. And
was he running it on canola?
Yeah, recycled veggie oil. super Portland.
Yeah, he used to get it from like Indian restaurants and things like that. He would roll around and ask for their used oil.
Like a Portlandia skit, like for real.
Wow.
So, except like 12 years ago.
Right.
So we would, go to the theater. We would email Andrew a few times and be like, what time are we setting up? And like, so at some point he would finally get back to us and be like, oh, like whatever on Friday. And so we would show up and around 2:00 and just like roll in, load all our stuff in, set our tables up. And then sometime around 5:30 to 6:00, there would start a giant line would start forming outside the theater with people, noses pressed up against the glass.
Oh, like, yeah.
The doors are early this year. And, once we established all the vendors were ready, go down and open the doors and everyone flood in, get their popcorn, get their sodas, and check out all the vendors in the upstairs and downstairs lobbies, get their programs. We have a vintage newspaper style program. So it's actually newsprint printed by a company down in, where is that? Near Salem. Yeah. But they're like the only company in a tri-state area that does this kind of printing. But it's like, the black and white newsprint. We've got the schedule and all the films, and like fiction. Dark Horse is doing a center spread mythos comic strip for us in the middle of it. And articles and pictures and descriptions of all our panels and stuff.
We always make folk like Glancy himself write an article or two for us to liven things up.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes and that's just the program. So you've got there's films, there's seminars and panels, a bunch of those too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when we first started coming to it back in I think 2002 was our first year, 2001 or 2002, and back then it was definitely much more films. But over the years, Andrew, when he was running it, started incorporating more. He would have panels like on Saturday and Sunday afternoons in the theaters. But we've progressed to the point now where it's so far along that it's almost a full convention-style event.
Hmm.
So last year was the first year we rented out the Hollywood Senior Center, which we lovingly call the EOD Center. That's where all of our, a lot of our panels and readings and things like that happen now. Last year we just sort of tried it out, but this year there's going to be a whole slate of programming, of panels, readings. We're also going to have an alternative film track in there.
So do I take it that the senior center is not a residential senior center?
That would be the best shit ever if we were stepping over Ma and Pa Kettle.
It's not that kind of convention.
No, it's like an activity.
It's a community center.
Yeah,
gotcha.
But bunch of meeting rooms, bunch of open spaces that can be used for whatever.
So there's an area where we're gonna have an artist alley and an art show, and then there's an area with a stage where we're gonna do all the panels and readings. And then there's two kind of closed off rooms. One that has a projector and one that has like set up for game. We're gonna have gaming in one room and the alternative film track in the other room.
Yeah.
So it's all downtown. Is it all sort of, you know, within a couple of blocks of each other?
It's not really downtown. It's called the Hollywood neighborhood, the Hollywood district.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like Northeast 40th and Sandy, basically.
And the district is actually named after the theater.
Yeah. It's across the river from what is actually downtown. Yeah. And
so people refer to the convention center area and downtown is downtown,
right?
Mm.
But it's a little bit east of like the convention center area.
Yeah. But nearby.
But it's right on the MAX line, which is our light rail, light transit.
Yeah, it's only like a block or two away from the train station or the rail station.
About three blocks. Yeah,
it's like a easy five minute walk.
Yeah.
Now there was a time when this place was, the Hollywood Theater was surrounded by some truly charmingly rundown hotels, but most of them are gone now. One was turned into an office park.
Yeah.
And I don't know what happened to the Crack Hojo. There was that one Howard Johnson's that was behind the public library that mm-hmm. was just sort of spectacularly seedy. And it's gone away now. Now we're only left with the Banfield, I guess.
Yeah.
Which is still marvelously seedy. It is the only hotel that I have ever found a Ziploc baggie filled with money out in the parking lot.
So that's how Pagan stayed afloat that year.
No, certainly not. I turned that immediately to the front office. What do you take me for?
Fair enough. Are you going to be giving any be it any panels or events or running any games there, Scott?
Yes, I'll be running a game. I was a backer reward.
Yes.
People
can buy themselves a slice of Glancy.
Yeah, so I don't come cheap. I'm not saying that. But, you know.
So one of the other things that the Kickstarter did was we had to get sort of creative with some of our rewards, but it ended up being a really great thing because it added another dimension to the festival that we wouldn't have had. So last year, our guest of honor was Sandy Peterson, and we actually gave him the Howie Award, which is a lifetime achievement award.
Yeah, yeah.
It's for people who have just contributed greatly to bringing H.P. Lovecraft into the public eye and like contributing to the development of the genre, and just for all of his contributions to Call of Cthulhu and all of his other projects that he's continuing to together. So we had him do a Call of Cthulhu game, but of course, you know, only so many people can do that. So we had Glancy run another game on Sunday. So Peterson ran one on Saturday, Glancy ran one on Sunday, and it just was awesome. Like, people loved it. And we had Guardian Games, which is a local game store there, and they have like this fantastic wonderland of of games. It's like Geek Wonderland, Disneyland, I guess.
Yeah. It's usually the coolest game store I've seen in any city.
It's very cool. They came out and ran some game demos, and Keith Baker was a guest last year, and he's coming again this year. So he did demos of Cthulhu Flux and Gloom, and I just talked to Cryptozoic, and they're going to send us a couple of demo copies of the Doom that came to Atlantic City. Which,
oh, right, yeah.
Fun story about the Kickstarter for that one.
Yeah.
It's finally being produced, so we'll actually have like a physical copy at the show to show people if they want to play it.
And I'm sure Cryptozoic is doing it up nicely. I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah. For a long time, we've kind of been wanting to expand the kind of things that people can do, because all of us have Lovecraft in common, but then there's kind of offshoots where some people are more interested in the literary side, and some people came to it through the gaming side. And, you know, of course, there's the core base of fans that are really just in it for the films. Mm-hmm. But it was really nice to be able to add that on, and having the space at the Senior Center allowed it, but having the Kickstarter allowed it, too, because it kind of helped us reach a broader audience.
Yeah.
And it helped see that people wanted to do that kind of thing.
Your guest of honor is Ken Hyde, is that right?
That's right.
Yep. This time, yeah. Which is, he's not even a filmmaker. He just talks about it.
Nope.
Hey, he just knows everything.
He's merely an oracle.
Well, you know, I was on a panel with Ken at DragonCon last year, talking about, and the panel was called Cthulhu 101. I don't know if that was named after his book or if it was a happy accident. And it really struck me just how lucid and eloquent he is when he's talking about Lovecraft and the Cthulhu mythos.
Yeah.
And I immediately thought, like, I talked to him right after the panel and said, hey, how would you like to come out to the festival next year? Because I think he really, you know, he's really going to, you know, raise the level in the room, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Those of us who sort of write a lot about Call of Cthulhu and talk about it a lot in public and sort of put some kind of effort into not sounding totally stupid, it always wind up feeling a little abashed whenever we're in a conversation with Ken, because he's just so much smarter than everyone else in the room.
Yeah, it's a little depressing that way. Yeah, you're if you're around Ken, it doesn't matter what the topic, you generally feel like an idiot man-child, you know? Like, you should just, you know, be quiet and stroke that little red piece of cloth you keep with you, you know, and mutter prayers to it, and that will be about your contribution to the panel.
Which is to say, Ken's great, and he's a good choice.
A gentleman and a scholar.
Yeah, if he makes the rest of us that jealous, that's a good sign.
Yeah, definitely.
So when is the festival for those, again, for the listeners?
So the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival and CthulhuCon takes place on April 11th to the 13th.
Wow.
So it's coming up pretty soon, about 5 weeks.
But there's still tickets. I mean, people can still get there. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I'll be going to PAX East, which is the same weekend, but in Boston. April 11th through the 13th.
See, what you need to do there, Ross, you need to go to PAX West and to the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival.
Well, the company I'm working for right now, they're paying for my plane ticket to go to PAX East and my badge.
I guess you can't stop.
Right.
Yeah.
That might be hard to explain.
Yeah. But since the festival is a good way to segue into our main topic, I think, for the show. Are there any other last things you want to say about the festival before we moved on?
I should probably mention some of the other guests that we have coming, because they're...
Oh, yeah.
Totally.
Because Peterson's back for a second bite at this rotten apple. Apparently he enjoyed himself enough that you were able to bring him back without having to raise his purchase price.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We promised to give him apples, though. Can't get apples in Texas, apparently.
It's not like you can bribe him with booze and caffeinated beverages.
True. Sandy's back, and we also have Michael Sisko, which is a fantastic author, and he's another one that speaks really intelligently about Lovecraft, and so Both he and Ken are going to be great to have on panels.
Yeah.
Joe Pulver is coming out.
Yay!
He was one of our stretch goals for the Kickstarter this year, as is Robert M. Price. And our artist guest of honor is Alan Kay, which I know you've seen illustrations by him and everything, Weird Tales and Asimov's. He's had over a 40-year career of doing Lovecraftian illustration for all sorts of pulp and science fiction magazines.
Nice. I've actually I finished recently a season of Carcosa, which was edited by Joe Pulver, and one or two stories in there. Good stuff. Great stuff.
Yeah.
And
let us not forget that we also are getting Cody Goodfellow, who's always a worthwhile addition to any Lovecraftian event. And what, actor Doug Bradley is going to do some live readings?
Yes.
That's right.
That's right. Pinhead.
Well, wow.
Pinhead's coming.
Pinhead, as it turns out, he's not just an actor, but I think we all knew that already. He's an intelligent guy. He's well-read. He actually puts out his own line of audiobooks, which are all readings of classic gothic horror stories from like Poe and Bierce and Arthur Conan Doyle and all that good stuff, as well as Lovecraft. He has several Lovecraft stories in there in his Spine Chillers audiobook series. So he's going to come and he'll take part in a panel. He'll be at the VIP party, schmoozing with everyone. And
we get Yoshi again. ST Yoshi is going to be back.
Yes, he'll be back.
He's not there every year, but he's back this year, so that's good.
Yeah, I think it worked with his schedule this year because he's in a choir, and he also does, is it hockey? That's not right. Something about that doesn't sound right.
Although I would pay good money to see ST Yoshi, play hockey. I think that sounds perfect, but all right.
But anyway, he'll be coming out because it worked well enough with the schedule, and he's letting us put him on a couple panels, which I think is great because it'll...
Peter Rolick, Ross Lockhart, who did the Book of Cthulhu 1 and 2, who edited, put that together, is going to be out. The guys from the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society, Sean Brinney, and Andrew Lehman are going to be making...
They're actually going to be doing a live on the stage production of a brand new Dark Adventure Radio Theater play that no one has heard yet.
Yeah, so they haven't recorded it.
There's another premiere, and let us not also forget, on the subject of premieres, Dead Shadows.
Yes, yes.
What are we talking about there?
This is a French film that actually Glancy brought to our attention last year.
Last year, yeah.
And we tried and tried and tried to get in touch with the filmmaker to let us play it at the festival, and finally got a hold of him, I think last fall, and got a screener copy and did it all up. So we're doing the U.S. premiere of Dead Shadows, which is a creature feature horror movie.
It has shades of The Color Out of Space in it. So it involves a meteorite which lands and causes horrible mutations, and it's cool. It's got great effects. It's sexy. It's smart. For some reason, we just haven't gotten it here in the U.S. at all.
Yeah.
Even though it's been bouncing around in Europe for a couple of years.
So are you bringing a subtitled version over?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah.
The friends of mine who found copies available for commercial sale from Europe using, European PAL-coded DVDs were horrified to find out that the only subtitles they could find on this French movie were German and Spanish and Italian or Turkish. There was no English dubbing on the copies they got. So, this is really going to be the first time I've seen it, and I have been stalking this film online, trying to find a source for it that it wasn't just outright piracy.
Right.
And this is it. This is it.
Now, it will be coming out on DVD later, but we managed to slip in there and get them to give us a theatrical screening first. So.
That's awesome.
It's going to be a lot of fun. I mean, we're also showing a great The Curse of the Crimson Altar, and I know you've seen that one, Scott.
No, I have not seen Curse of the Crimson Altar.
It's also known as Crimson Cult. It's got
Yes, Boris. It's a Karloff, right?
Yep, Karloff, Christopher Lee, and Barbara Steele.
Yep. I am, in fact, familiar with that one. I've seen it. But it's one of those films that's had like 19 titles, like Horror Hotel.
Yeah.
It has had a lot of titles.
And we also were showing it's a short film. We actually have a short film from the current Lord Dunsany. So the Lord Dunsany we always talk about with Lovecraft is the 18th Lord Dunsany, if I'm not mistaken. The current one is the 21st Lord Dunsany, a fellow named Randall Plunkett. And as it turns out, he's a filmmaker, and he makes horror movies.
Well, that's perfect.
Isn't that something? And his film was brought to my attention by S.T. Joshi, who had just visited Dunsany Castle after he accepted the World Fantasy Award in Brighton this last year. And he got to tour Dunsany Castle and talk to Randall Plunkett, and he showed me this DVD. I said, well, I'm going to have to look that up and see if it's appropriate. Yeah, it's cool. It's a very good film. We're showing it.
And, that's just awesome.
Yeah.
And we're not showing it just because it's Lord Dunsany. You know, I mean, it's...
Right.
It happens to be also a very accomplished, very nicely put together film that just has a great little piece of trivia attached to it, which I think is awesome.
That's interesting. So I'm curious, is he sort of well-versed in his famous ancestor's work, you know? And I mean, how is he going to talk to that at all?
Well, he's...
Or I guess he's probably not at the show.
No, yeah, he won't be coming to the show.
Right. Yeah, no, that's pretty cool, though. That does make me really curious to sort of, is, you know, did he kind of discover what Dunsany the 18th was was most best known for and embrace that, or that's fascinating.
Well, he did express...
He undoubtedly found a trunk full of his ancestors' possessions, you know, possibly with a concurrent, portraiture painted over it.
Indeed. he did say that he felt, while some of his precursors there didn't sort of take up the mantle, he felt that he and his great-grandfather really had a lot in common. He was interested in the sorts of things that he did.
Yeah. That's
great. Interesting.
So I guess, Brian and Gwen, interplay is there between the show that's in Portland and then the one that's in Los Angeles? So, because there's the two film festivals are sort of, it winds up being one every 6 months, more or less, right?
Yeah. So the one in, so when it looked like Andrew Migliori was going to walk away from the festival and there weren't going to be any more, we were all sort of all talking together about, and I say all of us, I mean, Gwen and I and Andrew and Aaron Vanek, who was actually a filmmaker who's one of his first independent films was an adaptation of Lovecraft's The Outsider.
Mm-hmm.
And that was shown at the very first H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival here in Portland in 1996. And so he's been part of the festival family since then. And he, upon discovering that there may or may not be a Portland festival, he said to Andrew, well, hey, how about if I start one in L.A.? Because he lives there in Los Angeles. And so he started that up, and I think he just had the 4th in September, or the 3rd in September, 4th in September, and I think this coming September will be the 5th annual.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's a great guy, and he's got a good eye for films. The setup is a little different. Because he's got, whereas we have 3 screens with a relatively smaller number of seats in each theater, he has one massive theater with one big screen that holds like 1,200 people. And that's great for getting a number of people in there, but it makes his program has to be a lot shorter. You know, we show stuff on 3 screens, so we can show a lot of stuff. He has to show a relatively limited amount of stuff compared to us, but it's a great show. It's cool, and it's the theater is this, a wonderful Art Deco Warner Grand in San Pedro.
Yeah. we show some of the same films. So anything that gets submitted for the Portland Festival also gets considered for the LA Festival.
Yeah.
But because we have sometimes three or four shorts blocks, whereas I think he only does like one or two.
Yeah.
Two shorts blocks.
Mm-hmm.
We play a lot more than he does, and like his taste in films is just a little bit different than ours, so sometimes different things get chosen for the...
Well, it's interesting. I mean, if you went to both shows, they're both a lot of fun, but you can definitely see the Portland in one and the LA in the other one, and I don't mean that in any derogatory way, but they're very different shows. You could go to both and not feel like you were doing the same show twice.
Like, they're definitely not cookie cutter.
No.
Like, they have their own personalities.
Is there a Mall of Cthulhu down there in LA?
Yeah. And it's similar in size. Yeah.
There's different vendors, because he tends to get more local people, whereas we tend to get more local people here. So he's got Cthulhu pickles and the Lovecraft Historical Society. And
yes.
Did you say Cthulhu pickles?
Yeah, there's a company called Cthulhu Pickles now. And Fezzarama. And,
mm-hmm. No, you're not going to get away with just saying Cthulhu Pickles and walking away from that. Throwing it down in the middle of the room, because we didn't hear anything you said after Cthulhu
Pickles. So it's not pickled Cthulhu. It's actual pickles.
All right.
But is Cthulhu Pickles.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the company named maybe Mythos Pickles or something like that.
Oh, maybe.
But he's got a Cthulhu Pickles. I think the idea is there'll be, I'm probably putting words in the guy's mouth, but I think the idea is that there'll be different sorts of pickles, like, and I'm just making this up, but there might be an Arlothotep Pickles.
So what, like a, okay.
I'm going to Google right now.
I'm already ahead of you. They're apparently a product of Wicked Pickles. And I'm not. I didn't know that there were like artisanal pickles. I didn't know that
I would have thought that the Cthulhu pickles would be beyond human concepts of good and evil, so that perhaps it wouldn't really be appropriate for wicked pickles to be.
It's for when your meal needs that extra dimensional something.
Yeah.
Literally. Okay.
All right. So beyond Cthulhu pickles, you were saying there were other things?
Could there really be anything beyond Cthulhu pickles?
There are Fezzarama sets up down there. They have these really cool Fez hats.
Yeah, Fezzarama, if you haven't seen them, they do those. They're the ones that do the Fezzes with the big embroidered Cthulhus on them and things like that. And they have some really cool stuff. I don't have a hat myself, so I don't wear them, but. They have some great, and they even have women's style hats, which are very adorable, with Cthulhus and things on them.
Yeah, they're really nice, nicely made.
But yeah, no, it's a great show, and he gets a lot of the folks which are more local there, like Cody Goodfellow's out of the LA area.
Mm-hmm.
My artist Mike Dubish is out of Phoenix now. He was in San Diego, I think, but he always comes out for it, and. Because he's there in LA, it's easier, he can, Aaron has more access to folks which are in LA, producers and directors and things like that. So last year he had Sandy King, which is John Carpenter's wife, and the producer of In the Mouth of Madness.
Mm-hmm.
Had her come out and talk about the film, and he showed In the Mouth of Madness. It's a good fun time, and there's a little bit of short film overlap, and we work with each other, like we print his T-shirts, and we talk about films back and forth, about what films to show, and things like that. But they're definitely two very different shows, and I ain't just saying that. It's
So up in Portland, you've got Cody and Robert Price are good. Both are they doing a prayer breakfast?
So not this year. We did one last year.
Oh, what a shame.
But nobody wants to get up at 8 in the morning. Let me rephrase
it. Lovecraft fans aren't morning people. I don't
want to get up at 8 in the morning to go do all this stuff.
The only person who's not hungover is Sandy Peterson.
Right?
On Sunday morning. It's just,
it's unfair. It's really unfair. So this year, instead of, and we weren't sure that we were going to be able to bring Robert Price out again. So we wanted to make a plan where we could do something with the things that we knew were a sure thing. And that was Cody. So we had pitched to him doing something with his newly split off Temple of Yogg-Sothoth. So for those of you who don't know, there's been a bit of a schism, the great schism of 2013 that happened at Necronomicon out in Providence, where Cody just and his faction has split off from the Cult of Cthulhu to form the Temple of the Geek Orthodox. Sorry, that's like a mouthful. The Geek Orthodox Temple of Yogg-Sothoth. And say that three times fast, yeah. And I'll buy you.
I don't want to risk it.
So we're going to do a recruitment drive and spaghetti dinner at the senior center, which is so fitting. So it's going to be Saturday evening. It's a completely separate ticketed event, and the tickets are up. And we'll be pushing that more once the Hollywood Theater tickets go on sale as well, which should be in the next couple of days. But that is going to be a whole thing with entertainment and really great food and beer and wine.
Yeah, really great food from one of our actual favorite restaurants here in Portland. We talk them into catering the event. Normally they don't do that sort of thing.
And I don't know what San Pedro has to offer the world, but the one thing about the Portland Festival is Portland is just one of the best food towns I've ever lived in.
Oh, really?
It's even better than New Orleans, and that was always sort of my bar, but for comparison. But Portland always has the experience of being able to get out and hit a couple of these oddball restaurants in the city is absolutely worth the trip to Portland by itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, having lived in New Orleans, also, we really appreciated the food there, especially when we first moved there. But New Orleans is a town with 10 dishes designed and prepared by 100 different world-class chefs.
Mm. Yeah,
Portland is a city with a massive amount of variety, a massive amount of food variety that New Orleans just doesn't have.
Yeah. It's much better. It's a smaller town, but it's better. It's better for grazing than Seattle is. It really is. And it can't be beat. It really can't. Plus, it's drinky. It's very, very drinky. So
I hosted a friend here recently. Came in. He was on a documentary film shoot in Southern Oregon, and he had the weekend off. He came up to visit for a week or for 4 or 5 days, and took him around to restaurants. And at the end, he said, "Okay, so I think I've done Portland. So let me see. I've eaten at strip clubs, or I've had really good food at strip clubs. I've been to like 10 strip clubs, and I've had a lot of
microbrews.
I've had a lot of microbrews. Mm-hmm. Is that pretty much it?" I said, "Well, wait, do we have Voodoo Donuts?" He went, "Yeah, no, I went to Voodoo Donuts after you guys went to bed. All right, then I've done everything."
It's really tough to beat the what's it called, the Acropolis. I guess we shouldn't talk about the Acropolis on this.
No.
Someone else is going to have to do that this year.
We used to, when we were lowly vendors, we used to run the yearly, not run, but we would coerce a few somewhat willing souls like Scott to come with us to the Acropolis to have steak and eggs with the strippers on the Sunday morning of the festival.
Yeah, and I want to point out that the Acropolis was a place that, outside had this sort of weird Grecian columns painted on the outside of the building, and the sign has certain like a lintel front of like a Greek Parthenon or something as part of the way the sign is set up. And you go in, and yes, there is a big statue of like a life-size statue of Neptune with sort of Nodensy with a couple of porpoises and some half horse, half fishes.
Yeah.
That's all in there. But then the rest of the decor inside this place is all country Western. All country Western, right down to the part where the stages are designed to look like cow pens.
Yeah.
And you'd go into this place at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, and they'd serve you a $6 steak breakfast. It was the only stranger strip joint would have to be Jumbo's Clown Room in Los Angeles.
I like that you know this. I like that you have
Shauna Waldron, who starred in Aaron Vadeck's The Yellow Sign, right? She plays the main character in that. I get out to L.A. and she's like, and I stayed with her for one night, and she says, "Hey, you know," goes driving across the country, so I'm just doing sleepovers at various, you know, people who are foolish enough to put me up. And she says, "Hey, listen, there's this place I really want to show you, but before we go, you have to promise to leave your handgun behind." Which, you know, if anything is guaranteed to make you bring a gun, because we've seen the movies and we've seen the TV shows, you have anything is there to just, you know, to make it, yes, I will leave my firearm behind.
Yeah, that's the part of the game where the GM is asking you, so are you armed?
Yeah, and so the result is I start strapping it on like I'm fucking Travis Bickle, you know, where I've got a, you know, K-bar duct taped to my boot, you know, and three different pistols, and we get there and we pull into a parking lot of this sort of half a strip mall, the kind of thing you'd expect like a 7-Eleven to be in, you know, with like maybe a dying pet store, you know, the next one over. But instead is this Jumbo's Clown Room. And I don't know what to say, except it was like a strip bar from a David Lynch movie. it was like this bar filled with crusty old guys who were just drinking. It was like the cast from Barfly at one end of the place, and they're all hunched over their beers, right? And there's all this clown art all over the walls, which is not enhancing my calm. And that's one end of the place. And they're all just kind of over their beers, drinking, and they're not even looking around. They're not even turning around and looking the other way. And then stuck into the back of the bar, kind of at a weird angle, like maybe the bar was driving along, it was going through an intersection, and it was T-boned by a strip joint, is just this stage with a pole with no backstage. There's a curtain covering a brick wall. You know, there's no backstage. It's like a boom box that the girls are using to, you know, play stuff on. And there are these strippers performing, and it is like the Burlington Coat Factory of strippers. I mean, it's all the off-brand Maynard strippers.
There's, I was going to say, so it's a good value.
there's a girl with her arm in a cast. there was a pregnant girl. There was a girl in her 50s who was covered with so much ink she looked like a Yakuza hitman. And there's this great moment where the girl with all the tattoos is performing. Nobody's looking at her, right? Nobody in the bar is looking. Everybody's just hunched over their beers. It's like the girl's being completely ignored by the clientele. She's going through her steps, and these other group of women come into the bar, sit down in the front row. They recognize each other. She just stops performing, sits down on the edge of the bar, takes a cigarette off a friend. They just start smoking and talking. But she keeps her ass on the stage until the song ends, and then she gets up and finally comes around to their table and sits down once the song is over, as if there's some stripper ethics. Man, you do not leave the stage until you're, you know, until every rose has its thorns.
The job is not yet done until the job is done.
Yeah, so, it was, the only thing that was missing was, like, you know, maybe some midgets or clubfoot stripper. I mean, it was,
or if the strippers were actually clowns.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that did not
happen. Something to shoot for.
Literally. that's the only place that's honored in the Acropolis.
I think I have to run. I have to write a Call of Cthulhu scenario based on Jumbo's Clown Room now. Like, I mean, I got to submit it to the
other. I already used it as a place where the two Delta Green agents meet up in Los Angeles. Go on their mission. It's like, all right, you'll meet him at Jumbo's Clown Room. It's like, are you the what? You know, ASL hangs up before it can get more specific.
Right.
Click. Did Alphonse say jumbos? And then, of course, they get
he's trying to kill us, isn't he?
And when they get there, you know, the agent's on their way across the parking lot, and this car pulls up, and it's the other agent, and the guy gives the countersign, you know, to get in the car. It's like, I thought we were supposed to meet inside, and the guy's like, there's fucking clowns in there. Fuck that. Just get in the car, you know. We got a mission to do. So, yeah, so Jumbos has already appeared. And, of course, I don't remember who I turned that story into, but they're like, I thought Jumbos Clamor was a nice touch. And I'm like, you know, that was really imaginative. No. And the Acropolis, ladies and gentlemen, is almost like that. It's almost like that. Insofar as it's got its weirdness. I mean, the whole country western thing, the weird cattle pen dance stages, and my favorite part, the staircase that goes upstairs to the dressing room, and as the girls come down the stairs, they pass one of those charts that shows where all the steaks come from on the cow.
Wow!
And
so have to get from the stairway to the rest of the room. They have to go through the stage where one of the dancers are dancing.
Yes,
she has to like cut through.
There's just a lot of traffic through that stage. Yeah.
It's sort of got this sounds like a postmodern kind of meat market motif going on.
Oh yeah. And, well, there's just this moment where you know the one girl showed up and did a terrible act because it's you know it's not the A team. At 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, right? So this is your B and C list, you know. And she kind of wandered around the stage, did kind of like a naked panhandling thing, which was just appalling. And then she left, right? Well, I mean, you know, she just wanders up with no clothes on and asks for a tip, and that's not how you strip. You know, put some goddamn energy into it, you know.
Let's just cut to the chase here. You know,
yeah.
I'm naked. I need money.
Yeah, exactly.
You have money.
Now I realize essentially that is the heart of all stripping. But I'd like some. I would like some sizzle with my steak, so to speak. And so, yeah. And so she wandered away after doing a terrible performance, totally just kind of bored out of her mind. We're all bored too. And she wanders away, and then within like 3 minutes, my steak arrives. And I'm like, so what happened to Cinnamon? Oh, she's done for the day. You won't be seeing her again. Really? So, like, you don't cover your stage fees. You know, the management has another option. It's an odd place.
So there's no prayer breakfast, but you can have one there.
We could have one. Yes, there. Yes. I should point out that so
we're replacing the prayer breakfast with a literary brunch upstairs at Sam's Billiards, which all is right. Steps okay. away from the theater.
So after exit well. at the Acropolis, then
yes.
Yeah. Awesome. Now I really want to go. Like
I mean, that's the point.
I want to get to, like I mean, it sounds like it's bleeding into unknown armies at this point, and like. And I feel like my life is incomplete unless I've been to the Acropolis or Jumbo's clown room.
I'm uncomfortable with, you know, Tynes or Robin Laws or Ken Hyde going into those places. There was a time where the night before the festival started, everyone would go and spend a night out at the Grand Lodge, which is a hotel like 20 miles outside of Portland that is built in the ruins, or it is a refurbished Masonic retirement home.
That's an ideal.
From the 20s.
Yeah.
And on the same grounds, before it was shut down, was also a Masonic orphanage. And, you know, we couldn't do it. We went in there, we're just, you know, well, we can see how this works. You know, there's mm-hmm. that point where Mr. Jeffries, the 90-year-old, begins babbling about how he wants his mommy and he's six. Mm-hmm. You know, and they're like, mm-hmm. He just has, you know, finally the Alzheimer's is.
Sure.
Is meanwhile, little Jimmy has gotten to be a very serious young man.
Right.
But there's a, it's an amazing complex. And if you ever get out to Portland to the festival, you should take some time to track down the Grand Lodge. It's part of the McMiniman's chains of they refurbish old defunct things. Like they refurbished the County Poor Farm into a, you know, sort of hotel entertainment complex and
a winery, and
a distillery, and they make all their booze for their restaurants there. But I will point that we used to go to the Grand Lodge and just be creeped the fuck out before the festival started.
You made a statement, Scott, at the beginning that, you know, when we came from a mythosy town of New Orleans to the unmythosy Northwest. I mean, I was actually thinking, well, we have McMiniman's.
You do, and you have Astoria.
Yeah, right. And we have Astoria, which may as well be Innsmouth.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. Yeah, it certainly it's sub for Innsmouth in Cthulhu, and we should get on and start talking about movies, shouldn't we?
I don't know. I kind of want to hear more about the droids.
All right, Ross, here's the last thing for Ross.
Yeah.
The McMiniman's Hotel, the Grand Lodge, is covered in all this weird folk art. It's all over, including this completely fucked up poem that's written on one of the walls that shows these little children playing in a room, and then there's like a hole in the floor and these weird fairy faces staring up out of the basement through the hole, and then there's this poem that the last lines is, and the ones that were are coming back again are returning. There's this whole, you know, stars are right thing at the end of the poem that's painted on one of the walls. But the big main staircase of this place, of the Grand Lodge, goes up. It's a big turning staircase, and there's a giant mural on one of the walls of an aerial shot of the Grand Lodge. And it's looking down on the lodge and the subsidiary building, which is the orphanage and the big grounds. Painted in the foreground of this painting is a woman in 1920s clothing, like wearing one of those old 1920s caps and sort of flapperish, who's apparently kneeling in a little cart, and the cart is being pulled through the air, which is clearly like night sky kind of set up with stars on. She's being pulled through the air by a black goat. Okay, now that's troublesome. But
I'm sort of convinced that if you went around to all the different McMiniman's properties and you compiled a book of all the art painted on their walls, that you would end up with sort of a Necronomicon-like grimoire of of something that would almost certainly open a gate if you gazed on it.
So right next to is the orphanage. We went into the old orphanage has been turned into conference rooms. The idea is you can rent the main grounds of the lodge and the rooms, and there's a big restaurant in it that's very good, and there's also upstairs there's an old theater that used to put on plays for the retirees. So there's huge space upstairs. But next door, the orphanage has been turned into conference rooms. And so we went in, and on our last day, we were exploring around there, and I walk into this big conference room, and I step into the room, and I look around at the three walls I can see in front of me, and I walk into the room, and I turn around to leave, and as I turn, next to the door, on the wall that I couldn't see because it was behind me, is this 3-foot by 3-foot black and white photograph of the grounds of the Grand Lodge, showing the Grand Lodge in the background. And front and center is a woman in 1920s gear in a goat cart being pulled by a black goat.
Jeez.
It was like, the painting was disturbing, but then to actually see the photograph, where it's like, you're like, oh, it's from somebody's imagination. No, it's not.
It was drawn from life.
It was drawn from life, Mr. Pickman. Yes, that is exactly right. So there you go, Ross. Have I put enough?
And
cheese?
You're going to be in Boston for me.
I know where I'm staying next time I go up there. So.
Have I put enough cheese down for you?
All right, fair enough. All right. Cthulhu Mythos movies and TV is the nominal topic of this episode.
Not Portland's weirdness.
Although that is a great episode topic.
So. You know, we've got Brian and Gwen here, and of course the rest of us. But
yeah,
what to you guys? What makes what makes a good Cthulhu mythos, a good sort of video adaptation of a Lovecraftian story? You know, which ones have you seen that you just, that really just blew you away, and how did they do that?
Well, you know, I actually come from it, and I think this is what makes it a good fit that we're organizing the festival now, is that I kind of love it all, man. You know, like, I like the cheesy, stupid ones, maybe not as well as I like the really scary, great adaptations.
What would you consider cheesy, stupid, like Reanimator or From Beyond?
Well, yeah. I mean, although Reanimator, and Reanimator gets a lot of flack for not being very faithful to Lovecraft because of all the sex and gore and women folk.
Slapstick.
And slapstick. But, you know, I think you know, if you've read the story, a lot of it really does ring true in the film. So as adaptations go, I don't think Reanimator is all that bad. From Beyond maybe is not, doesn't really hit the story notes very often. But they all have a little something. And I think for me, you know, if a film has a kind of a moment or creates this frisson of like cosmic horror in you, or even if it's just a moment of the weird or uncanny, in a lot of ways it accomplishes the things that Lovecraft wanted. And I see that in a lot of... we just watched a great film, which we're going to... we haven't accepted it yet. But so hopefully the guy is okay with us showing it. But it's called Vomica, and it's an amazing, amazing film. It's World War One.
Excellent.
World War II.
Maybe no. It's World War II. But it's, you know, it's a nice little low budget production. But and independent filmmakers are always working with less, of course, than the studios have. So sometimes their friends are the actors, and they're writing the script and directing and doing the editing. And when that all comes together, it's really great. And this film, really, towards the end of it, there is a moment where I was, and this doesn't happen to me very often, where I was sort of like pulling my feet off of the floor, like, and pulling back into the couch while we were watching it. It really effectively produced this sort of
unsettling tension.
Unsettling, uncanny moment, almost like, you know, it was evocative of Rats in the Walls and also like Nyarlathotep, and it was very, very cool. And every once in a while you get one of these films that doesn't do it for just a moment, but does it for a good part of the film. Hmm. And it's really a treasure when you find those. But you know, but there's
like AIM-1200.
Like AIM-1200, and that's a wonderful Lovecraftian film.
Yeah, that you can't.
Oh yeah, I recently watched that too.
You can't underestimate how good that film is. You can't undersell it.
Yeah.
At all.
But I think we should talk about the elephant in the room, or the sort of genesis of this episode idea, which wasn't the film festival per se, but a TV show that I think we've all watched. True Detective has certainly captured the minds of everyone who's seen it, at least according to my Facebook feed.
Yeah, there was no way I was ducking those spoilers. Everybody, John Tyne said something about how, like, everybody and his dog and the internet, you know, showed up on his doorstep to blow that for him.
Right.
Yeah.
There's no way around that. When that reveal happened in episode two, like all of a sudden, you know,
the name drop. Yeah.
I would have loved to have been the first Lovecraftian or Chambers fan to watch that episode and just be like, whatever, I'm watching this cop procedural, and then have that sort of creep out of
the screen. No. The moment when you are a Lovecraft or a Chambers fan is you're watching episode one and they're having the interview in the cell with the ex-husband. And he says, she contacted me. Spoilers, everyone, right?
Yeah.
Fucking turn off your podcast right now.
Right. You haven't seen episode one.
And he says, she was, you know, she was high. She kept talking about how she'd met a king. Now, if I had thrown that line out of an NPC's mouth in front of a group of players playing Call of Cthulhu, there would have been that moment of, you know, that pained expression all around the table, like, king, okay. You know.
Way to give the game away.
I imagine sitting in my chair, if that had happened to me, if it had not been, you know, given away, I would have thought, oh, wow, if this was a Call of Cthulhu thing, that would be pretty ominous. But since I'm watching HBO, right, that's not going to happen. So that when they come around to episode two, it would have been like getting punched in the balls.
Right.
And being horrified because they told you they were going to punch you in the balls, and you didn't. They gave you the hint. And, you know, it was right.
Yeah, if this was a place where people actually punched you in the balls, I'd be scared right now.
Yeah. And it was just such a, you know, and I've had people tell me they jumped off the couch.
Yeah, I can only imagine, because I only heard about it from those people having jumped off the couch and started freaking the fuck out. So yeah. I immediately went back and watched episodes 1 and 2, because I hadn't bothered, because up until now, you know, Matthew McConaughey sort of annoys the hell out of me and my wife both so deeply that we would just not bother to watch the show. And then everybody kind of went berserk. So we went back and started watching, and it's like, oh my God, it's good, and he's amazing. And
yeah, and really should have gone berserk over his performance alone.
Yeah, yeah,
This thing really doesn't need the chamber stuff to drive it. Conaughey's fucking unbelievable,
right?
In this, he's really.
That's the thing that sort of strikes me about this show is that the Chambers touches, the Carcosa references, are kind of, they draw their power not from them being supernatural, but from the way that people in the story are using that mythology to, sort of as an excuse to abuse people who are less powerful than them, you know?
Yes.
And so it actually has way more resonance as sort of just another mythology than it would if it were actually a supernatural thing happening. And I think that's really interesting to me as a storytelling choice and device that they made, choosing that particular mythology and bringing it in and the role that it plays in the thing. It would be fascinating to kind of see another version of the story where the supernatural stuff was actually at the heart of it, because of course that's what we're all doing in our games. Mm-hmm. But
I think the interesting thing about True Detective is theoretically, I mean, it could be supernatural, but I mean, we don't know until we see the last episode of, you know, season 8 or episode 8.
Maybe,
but it could be the entire thing can go along, and the way the Cthulhu mythos, you know, the actual supernatural elements work in it is that I think it works better when it's something that is this alien incomprehensible force that is often undetectable, that cannot be perceived by human senses. And I think
that you have to be a little mad to perceive it, which is why all of our, you know, all of our cultists or all of our people connected with it have been, you know, sort of these drug burnout cases.
Well, everyone's an unreliable narrator. And yeah. I mean, the two detectives especially are capable of self-delusion and self-rationalization.
And you see that in the moment when, you know, fucking Rustin Cole sees the yellow sign in the sky. Right, yeah. Because birds, he's still... Yeah.
Well, but they marvelously established that, you know, he still has trailers.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, in his eyesight from all the time he spent as a junkie undercover. Mm-hmm. So he's unreliable even to himself.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not just that, you know, he knows that he's unreliable.
Right.
So
that could all happen, but like the one supernatural X factor or whatever it is could be something that just like in a lot of the best Delta Green games is just something that there's never going to be the story structure of a Lovecraft thing. I think it's better when, you know, Lovecraft had to explain stuff when he was writing, like, oh, I found the book that explained the cosmic secrets that is capping around, because otherwise it wouldn't make sense at all to the reader, and everyone's just like, oh, a bunch of things that happened. But now that we know the basic structure of it, we as the reader, as the audience, can perceive the framework that the characters inside of it cannot. So you could have a supernatural element that no one realizes and picks up on. So there could be, the killer could be a supernatural, he could be summoning a monster, he could be doing something else, and we would never know. So I think that's what I like about it.
I think one of the important reasons that using the Chambers King and Yellow mythology works for this kind of show is, it, you know, if they were using a Lovecraftian mythos, you would really want there to be this suggestion that there were alien entities or deities behind the scenes. But Chambers never really gave us the supernatural.
Right.
You know, right. Chambers was all about, or, you know, the five or six stories he wrote that involved the King in Yellow were really about how the disenfranchised saw the world differently. You know, it's all, they're all unreliable narrators, as I think somebody just said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the Chambers stuff. And then for me, because I keep saying people, like, I keep seeing people on Facebook saying, well, I mean, don't get your hopes up. True Detective's not going to go all mythos-y. Like, well, I don't think it's going to go Lovecraftian mythos, but I think it's already gone sufficiently Chambers mythos-y.
Right.
In the sense that in Chambers, you never know if Carcosa's actually there.
Or if it's just a matter of perception.
Right, right.
Let's also not forget the two other major factors. Number one is Thomas Ligotti.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first thing I read about True Detective was, oh my God, somebody cracked open Thomas Ligotti's The Conspiracy Against the Human Race and formed Rustin Cole's philosophy right. out of that.
Right.
Yeah. Which is a fascinating book because I can never quite tell if Ligotti is giving us a philosophical treatise or if he is fictionalizing the darkest, most depressing,
mm-hmm.
most cosmically, you know, sort of horrified perception of the world. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can never quite tell if he's being genuine or if he's trying to create a cosmic horror, a horrible sense of, you know, emptiness through this, in, that maybe it would have been hard to do in fiction with a tentacly monster or something, but instead he is just merely doing with, you know, man's place in the universe. And the other thing, has anyone else noticed the whole, you know, Carl Edward Wagner Styx thing?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when those little, you know, wreaths of Styx turned up, that's nowhere near Chambers. That's not in Chambers anywhere that I read.
Right. No, it's not.
That's right out of Carl Edward Wagner's Styx, which is a short story guaranteed to make everybody poop their pants.
Yes.
and of course, Edward Wagner was he did a Carcosa story that was in Chaosium's collection way back when.
Yeah, River of Night Stream.
River of Night Stream, yeah, which I loved as a Carcosa
story. No, which I actually remember in the it was interesting, the True Detective show creator, Nick.
Don't even try.
Yeah,
like Pizzolatto, maybe.
Yeah, Pizzolatto or something like that. He talks about, he did an interview that I think you linked to, Shane, talking about his influence. He talks about Carcosa. He specifically mentions a season in Carcosa as something people should read who like the King in Yellow mythos. And when I read the King, a season in Carcosa recently, in the introduction, Joe Pulver is like, here's what I consider to be the canon for the King in Yellow mythos. And he specifically mentions, aside from the Chamber stories, A River of Night's Dreaming, which is about, well, I don't want to spoil it, but it kind of goes like, you read that and you can see the themes over and over again in True Detective.
Mm-hmm.
Unreliable narrators, questions about sensuality and sexuality, perception, and certainly, like, this flat circle business certainly seems to come up. The M-brain theory and, you know, multiple realities and all that fun stuff. So,
and by fun, you mean cosmically horrifying.
Yes.
And it is actually doing a good job of presenting even what probably S.T. Yoshi would allow us to define as cosmic horror, which is a horror that is more about it's all about correlating your contents. It's one thing to say, "Oh, look, we live on a speck that's a third that orbits a third or fourth generation sun," you know, in a infinitely, expanding cosmos and, yes, heat, death, the universe. It's one thing to say those words. It's a completely different matter to actually internalize them and understand them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what, live your life under that doom.
Yeah, I mean, from time to time, I've seen people online kind of discussing and debating the merits of Cthulhu Mythos, particularly horror in the modern day, and whether you can pull it off, and sometimes you see people sort of take the position that it's less effective for them because in the modern day, we understand a lot more and have kind of gotten used to our the place of humanity in the cosmos.
And having Carl Sagan melodiously intone the word billions and billions, right, isn't the same thing.
And that's the thing is that while yes, that's true, the whole point is that when you actually sit down and start thinking about it, it doesn't take too long for most of us to sort of start feeling that kind of vertigo, of that sort of awful vertigo of sensing just how what scale we're talking about and comparing it to ourselves. I'm sure there are going to be people for whom that they just sort of shrug that off and they refuse to let it affect them and get scared by it, and okay, that's not really the audience that that we're going for anyway, and it's certainly not me.
Not to mention that they're the same folks who are going to shrug off the gore effects in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but stub your toe, break your finger, so it's pointing in the wrong direction. Suddenly it's all real.
Well, and that's the thing that, a show like True Detective, what it's done really well is present not just that perspective, but present the things that perspective does to somebody who doesn't go into denial about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it winds up being really a really effective kind of drama about that kind of terror, because it sort of explores it gives it room to breathe and sort of show the implications and what that does to you if you let it, and if you refuse to sort of flinch and shrug it off and not think about it. It's great stuff.
They tell you when you're to make an audience afraid. When you're watching a horror movie, you need to show characters who are afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the same way, Matthew McConaughey's, the characterization of Cole as this guy who has this, quarter-sized mirror on the wall that he looks into, and this kind of, just below the surface, him sort of holding in this, what he views as this cosmic reality, I think really is what lends so much of this dread to the show.
Right. Well, and also, he does such a great job of conveying the tension in that character. The tension between what the character says, which is that he's perfectly well accepted the fact that he's a meaningless person in a meaningless universe, and what's
Says the guy on a quest.
Right, which is underneath. he's still, there's still layers of that character that refuse to accept that, and yet he claims that he totally... I mean, that's just some genius-ass writing and acting right there.
Yeah. Certainly. So, bringing it back to the purpose of the podcast, the gaming side of it... when you watch something, like True Detective, how do you
or some you of the mind other movies that, for that have been really good and really effective?
Well, I want to throw out a few other titles that have
okay,
and just to possibly suggest some things that both were good, Lovecraftian monster moments, or were also good cosmic horror moments. Because
Okay.
For instance, everyone can agree that The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing, is one of the greatest horror movies that has ever been made. And it could have stressed the cosmic horror aspect of that movie. That moment where they're reading from Blair's journal, and it could have been a million things in a million worlds. The idea that they're up against something that is unfathomably old and unfathomably experienced, having been all these things. That moment came very close to being the sort of cosmic horror you get in Horror Express. Horror Express is a 1970s, looks like a Hammer horror film with Christopher Lee and you know, Peter Cushing. But the monster, the problem in that movie is a cosmic intelligence, a form of energy, as it pathetically tries to explain itself in Monkey Talk. a form of energy that was abandoned on Earth by its fellows and has inhabited every form of life on the planet since the single-celled organisms, waiting around, jumping from organism to organism, waiting for there to be a type of life on Earth sufficiently advanced to get it off the planet. And that's all it is doing. And yes, it's destroying people, all these people in its wake as it takes their knowledge and moves from body to body. But its goal is just to leave. It could give a crap about us. It doesn't want to do anything except leave. And having been dug out of the ice where it was sitting in a fossilized remains for several million years, it has fast-forwarded, I suppose, to a time when, Godard is just starting to work on rockets, you know. And I might be able to finally get my ass off this worthless pebble. and its perspective on, you know, its perspective on mankind and life on Earth, that's actually the cosmic horror moment in that film. And The Thing came very close to delivering that. But instead, we got a monster that roars a lot. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think The Thing sort of it leaves a lot of that implied. And I think it sort of brings it close enough to the surface that it gives a little bit of weight to the squeaky, you know, viscera.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing is, you know, cosmic horror is a very sort of, a niche taste in horror. I mean, and most, even a lot of horror fans don't really understand, let alone the mainstream audience. So I think certainly you see a lot in movies and in television that, like, John Carpenter is a big fan of Lovecraft and cosmic horror, as you can, you know, tell from his love letter In the Mouth of Madness, and he kind of touches upon that in Prince of Darkness.
Yeah, certainly, I think Prince of Darkness succeeds more on the cosmic horror stage.
And it was less commercially successful than The Thing. Yeah. Well, actually, no, they were both pretty bad. Neither of them did well at the box office.
But Prince of Darkness is considered a classic, and
not compared to The Thing. Like,
no,
Prince of Darkness has a much more mixed critical review, and it certainly didn't do as well as the box. Well, they both bombed at the box.
You know, it came at such a time when everybody was doing possession flicks and priest horror, you know, all these sorts of things. And I think that the problem is a film like that gets marketed to that sensibility. And what you get when you're actually seeing the theater is a table full of scientists talking about how Jesus was an alien.
Yeah,
That's part of what makes that film so brilliant.
And the nuance is lost. And I think a lot of people who are like in charge of movies, like not the directors but the producers and, you know, the money, they want to shy away from complex ideas. And it's hard unless you have. It's sort of like, you know, people go to art museums. They see Jackson Pollock. Well, my kid could paint this. Unless you have a background in sort of the like. In art, or in this case horror, you don't really get cosmic horror unless you've read Lovecraft and some of the scholarship about it and some of the other authors. You don't really, it's hard, it's not as easy to pick up as, like, there was a thing in the dark and it ate and it killed people and it was scary and it's coming after you. Ha 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 ha.
Well, I don't know that that's the case. I think it's more challenging to present a story that does that, but I don't think that's a limitation of the audience. Because, you know, most...
Well, I think it affects directors, like, you know, Scott talking about how it was the thing was almost a cosmic horror movie, and I think that's part of the reason why Carpenter probably didn't want to emphasize something more esoteric as opposed to the, like, hey, any of us could be a thing, you know?
Well, even Ramsey, even the original, what, who goes there? And I'm suddenly for blanking on the odd. Campbell?
Joseph Campbell, I think?
No, it's not. It's Campbell, but it's not Joseph, because that's the the author of all the mythology books. And it's not Ramsey Campbell. We'll just,
John W. Campbell.
Yeah.
John, yeah, that's right.
There is certainly, in that story, there is an implication of its ancientness. Of its age, of that, you know, we've encountered something that for us we are just a blip on its, you know, on its radar. You know, that mankind is insignificant compared to this entity we've encountered, and certainly our insignificance in the cosmos is one of the cornerstones of anything that's dealing with cosmic horror. I'm not sure if he quite Carpenter delivers a few Lovecraftian tropes in Cigarette Burns, which was an hour long episode for Masters of Horror. He does a pretty good job of sort of almost a Robert Chambers, you know, play you should not watch, film you should not see, sort of dread at the beginning of it. And sadly, the anything that they showed in the film just, you know, they, you know, couldn't measure up to, you know, the buildup. I would suggest that are you guys familiar with a film called Kill List?
I have it on my queue. I haven't watched on my Netflix queue.
Kill List is by the guy who just produced A Field in England.
Yeah.
He also did a thing called what's it called? Sightseers, which was about serial killers on holiday. Ben Wheatley is the guy's name. And Kill List is worth a look insofar as they actually give a moment of there's a number of moments of cosmic horror, of being utterly not the master of your fate, of the world turning around you in ways that you cannot affect. They're pretty good, but it's about a couple of hitmen who are given a kill list, obviously, of people they're supposed to wipe, you know, whack, and as they're going about their job murdering people, it automatically gets weird from the first hit. But there's this one hit where they go and they're observing the guy, and they see he goes to the little car lockup every day, and they decide, well, let's check out the lockup, you know, maybe we can kill him in there when he comes, because he goes every day. Maybe we can, you know, set up an ambush. So they go check out the lockup, and they find it's all full of this video dubbing, video duping stuff, and huge stacks of DVDs that are blank that he's burning in there. And then they watch, and they're, you know, there's the mouse, and there's the thing that says play on the computer, and they turn it on, right? And we've seen these two characters do some pretty heavy things up to this point in the film. We've seen them kill people. It's implied that they are absolutely reflexive murderers, you know. And they start watching it, and they don't show us what they're watching, but both of them break down crying and wailing like their children have died. You know, just this wail, and they didn't show it was on the film. They just had the actor's reaction to what was there, and nothing beats that.
Right.
Yeah.
Nothing beats that. There is nothing that the director can show me on screen that's going to top the look in their face.
Right.
And and yes, the whole job goes pear-shaped at that point. Obviously, there's this big discussion about how, you know, we're going to do this right. We're not going to just walk up and shoot him in the face in the middle of the street in broad daylight, right? We're going to be professionals about this. And sure enough, the next shot after they weeping into the camera is the two of them running up his front steps at full speed in broad daylight, kicking his door in, grabbing him, wrestling him over to a table in the kitchen, and beating his hands with a ball peen hammer until his fingers are all pointing the wrong ways. Mm-hmm. screaming at him, screaming, who else is involved? Who's holding the camera? You know, who are you sending these to?
That sounds an awful lot like a Delta Green game that I ran not long ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is on Netflix, is it?
Yes.
It is streaming, in fact.
Ah, that's awesome.
Schindler's List is brilliant until the last 2 minutes, in which case the film feels like the film ran out of the camera when they were shooting, and that's and that's how they decided the movie was over. But Kill List, it has aspects that you're going to recognize from The Wicker Man. It's like what would happen if The Wicker Man happened to guys who were heavily armed paramilitary assassins.
Okay.
And it doesn't help.
And without all the singing, I assume.
There is no singing that I... No, there was some chanting. There's some very unfortunate chanting. But yeah, that's not a terrible summation of Kill List. And of course, it's got that guy who was in a field in England who played O'Neill, Michael Smiley, who was tires on the bicycle delivery guy on Spaced.
Mm.
Does anybody remember Spaced?
Yeah.
Okay. He's one of these Englishmen with, you know, who should be posing for the big book of British smiles. but anyway, yeah, Kill List is absolutely worth your time, and it's
But you said that you felt like that movie was it sort of that moment that gave you that kind of this is a good moment of cosmic terror sense.
It certainly was a way of presenting something that was so horrible that the characters could not. The only way they could communicate the incident was through their emotions.
Right.
They couldn't actually communicate it, and that's what's always tough about some of these horrible reveals. admittedly, you know, in Carpenter's Cigarette Burns, having Udo Kier thread his intestines through the camera reel, and then run his guts through the camera was not a bad reaction to seeing the film no one should watch.
Right.
The Masters of Horrors episode. Yeah.
That was pretty good. That and the guy who was, he was writing his review.
Mm-hmm.
There was some character who was a journalist who apparently the audience rioted the first time the film was shown at a film festival. Much like King and Yellow, and
King and Yellow,
one reviewer, you know, described the film as terrorism. It was he described it as, you know, an atrocity committed on the audience. And when our hero tracks him down as the only person who's ever been willing to talk publicly about the film, he finds him in a cabin where every inch of the cabin is filled with bookshelves containing, you know, composition books. And he's like, you know, he says, well, what happened at the end of the film? He says, I don't know. I didn't see it. You know, I didn't see the end of it, but I, you know, so that's why I have to perform my penance. Your penance. I have to, you know, I have to write a proper review or something like that. His review was incomplete, the one that was published. So I'm writing a proper review of it and it'll be done soon. He's like, well, where is it? He's like, it's all around you.
Right.
And that moment right there, you know, that was another thing. It's like, okay, you know, yeah. I'm looking at the effect that this thing had on the guy. You can't show me the thing because it'll never be as good.
Right.
As its effect.
Right.
That really should always set off the klaxons when you walk into a fella's room and it's covered in bookshelves with composition notebooks. You know, that's
very
Seven vibe.
Yeah, if Seven taught us anything. Yeah. Or if there's a crazy wall. You know,
yeah.
If you go in and it's
a shrine, yeah,
it's either a shrine or Cole's case file,
right?
Yeah,
you know, from it's all over the wall. Yeah, yeah,
where it's clear he goes to sleep every night, being, you know, with these horrible photos of corpses pinned up above his bed.
Yeah,
because that's where he does all his studying. Yeah,
yeah, that's not good.
I think that's the key. Like you say, is. You know, you're watching these movies, and at some point they have to be about human beings and about the sort of the experience of a human being coming face to face with this kind of awfulness, and using that to sort of convey a reflection of that in the audience who's watching this thing.
And you know, on Netflix, there really is a lot of great independent films that at least have a taste of cosmic horror to them.
I agree.
The Objective. Have you seen that one yet?
Yes. Is that on? I've seen it. Yeah,
it is on Netflix now. The Objective definitely. It doesn't quite have an ending.
No,
but that build up feels like a Delta Green scenario.
There's
The Corridor is also a very good one.
The what?
The Corridor.
I was actually just going to mention that. It's a horror film. It's on there, and it's about a group of guys. The Objective is, of course, about a group of soldiers in Afghanistan who go on a secret mission, and you know, bad things happen in the desert. And that, I don't want to spoil anything about that. But The Corridor is about a group of five friends who go out to this cabin to sort of reunite. They've all been kind of estranged from each other. They like grew up together, and you know, various things happen. One of them. And then they find out the reason why they got estranged is one of the characters' mothers went insane, and that sort of affected that guy. And then they find out why she went insane is there's basically the way I see The Corridor, without spoiling anything about the movie itself, is I see it as sort of a record of what happens when humans make first contact with a great old one. You know, it's just like the great old one, Yog-Sothoth or whatever, just kind of incidentally brushes by in space-time in that one particular area. And the humans just go absolutely apeshit, and they don't. They're trying to understand what it is. You know, it's kind of like we're the monkeys in 2001's banging against a monolith, but it just ends up with them, you know, performing lobotomies or, on each other and just cutting each other up. And it's just the Netflix description doesn't really give it justice. So no.
It's definitely a film where the main characters are asked to make sand rolls like 10 times an hour throughout the film.
Yeah.
And so eventually everybody misses. You know, eventually everybody loses their role significantly enough.
Yeah. Even if you make it, it's 1d10, you know. Yeah,
that's right.
Speaking of Netflix, I should also throw out The Devil's Rock, which Devil's Rock actually goes so far as to name drop a couple of mythos critters during the black magic sequence. But The Devil's Rock is the best Nazis and the occult film I've seen in English. There's a film called Los Sin Nombres, The Nameless, that's made in Spain, that has a evil cult with a fascist Nazi occult connection to it. But The Devil's Rock is World War II.
That's based on a Ramsey Campbell one.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
But The Devil's Rock is, you know, Nazis doing an experiment in the Channel Islands. And I thought this was a nice touch. They're doing some demonology experiment in the occupied Channel Islands, which is British soil, that were these islands off the coast of France the Germans occupied. And one of the reasons they're doing it there, rather than in, you know, a bunker in Berlin, is if it goes wrong, the supernatural entity is surrounded by water, which many supernatural mythologies suggest that, you know, the supernatural cannot cross moving water or salt or iron or whatever it is. So, and plus it's English territory. If they lose the war, it's the British problem. You know, and I'd really give the Devil's Rock a good look. It may have some budgetary issues.
You know, that director has played the festival before.
Yes, which one is
he? He made Eel Girl.
Oh, Eel Girl. Yeah, that makes sense.
And Night of the Hellcats.
what does that mean, Scott? You had a tone there.
Well, Eel Girl, but certainly there is a whole lot of slimy, slithery female nudity. In both films.
It's not Japanese?
No, it's not. It's New Zealand.
I think the director is it Paul Campion? Is that his name?
I don't remember. I'll have to quickly look it up. But
it's Paul Campion.
But his main characters in The Devil's Rock are New Zealand commandos in World War II. So I presumed he was New Zealand. He was, you know, he was a New Zealand author, but you know,
maybe
I could be wrong. But Yeah, that one's quite good, and it's absolutely worth a look. I mean, yes, there are films that name drop the mythos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even The Stand, the book anyways, name dropped Nyarlathotep.
Well, Stephen King is unabashed name dropper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Leslie Nielsen throws out Azathoth and Nyarlathotep in the made-for-TV movie The Dark Intruder. You know, so no, well, it's Leslie Nielsen back when he was leading man material.
Yes.
Back when he was still, you know, going to Forbidden Planet and dealing with the monsters from the id.
This wasn't the Naked Gun confronts the Cthulhu cult.
No. Now, I will admit that the twisted mutant freak sorcerer in the story is played by Werner Klemper, but at no point does he call for Hogan.
Somebody just told me that you can see that Dark Intruder is at least up on YouTube.
Yes, there's a link that I got from the Lovecraft e-zine that had a bunch of films that are up on YouTube for free, like that are, you know, Reanimator from 85, 93's Necronomicon, Horror Express from 72, the incredibly strange Dunwich Horror from 2009, which appears to star every stripper in South Louisiana. Dagon apparently is up. Cthulhu is apparently up. There is somewhere online. Horror Hotel, which we mentioned earlier. And Cast a Deadly Spell, which is a film you can't get anywhere except on shitty, shitty VHS copies.
Even the DVD bootlegs you find are from the shitty VHS copies.
Yeah, Cast a Deadly Spell is one of these lost gems. And I'm not saying it's cosmic horror in any way, shape, or form. It's just amusing. It's just a love letter, you know, to Lovecraft. It's not, you know, anything real.
And Fred Ward is enjoyable in it, but it itself is just a tentacled, name-dropping sort of affair, not a serious work of cosmic horror.
No, but at least I have to admit that the name H. Philip Lovecraft.
Yes.
So he's Phil all the time, like Philip Marlowe was a brilliant touch. That really worked well.
And that was a made for HBO movie.
Yes.
In the late 80s, early 90s.
91.
But later on, HBO did create, I think, one of the best, like, straight Lovecraftian adaptations of any of his stories. Like, very faithful to the material, very scary, very well made. Dan O'Bannon's The Resurrected, which is Case of Charles Dexter Ward, which is available on DVD. I have a copy of it. Yeah. So it's
intermittently in and out of print. So if you find a copy, you should definitely get one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, in terms of being faithful to material, yet making it a great movie, a good horror movie, I think it's found the best balance out of any adaptation I've seen of one of Lovecraft's stories. I mean, I think there are better Lovecraftian movies, like in terms of the themes, but as a straight adaptation of one of his stories, I think it's the single best one.
Well, how do you guys feel about Dagon?
I mean, Dagon, the Stuart Gordon one?
Yeah, absolutely. The one that's really Shadow of Rensmith with the name filed off.
I thought it was a decent, like, kind of survival horror movie, but
yes,
very much, you know, running around. It kind of reminded me a little of that Call of Cthulhu video game for the Xbox, the original Xbox.
Dark Corners of the Earth, yeah,
Dark Corners of the Earth. And I thought it was decent, but I think Resurrected, especially the scenes where they're going into Charles Dexter or the Ward's old laboratory.
Yeah, descending into the labyrinth is absolutely one of, I mean, it's everything Lovecraft tried to communicate.
Yeah.
I think both of those films are reflective of the source material. You know, Charles Dexter Ward is such a brooding, you know, research kind of piece. Shadow of Innsmouth was Lovecraft's attempt, however ill-conceived. Who doesn't love Shadow of Innsmouth? But it was his attempt to write kind of.
Yeah.
I actually spoke to Dan O'Bannon about it briefly. I met him at a screenwriting conference in LA in like 2006, a year or two before he passed away. And he told me I brought up Lovecraft while he was talking. He was talking about horror and movies to the group of people. I brought up Lovecraft, and afterwards, I managed to talk to him. He said that one of his rare pleasures was, like, after the day was done and after they finished shooting, he would just go and sit in the set that they would use for the labyrinth and just sort of meditate in the dark about the universe. And I'm like, all right, yeah. That was, yeah.
So. Good on you, Dan.
Yeah.
That was a really great film. That was, you know, it's dragged down, and this is sort of what I was saying with having these moments of cosmic horror or weirdness that kind of buoy up a movie, is that you really remember, Resurrected is one of these films where you really remember the good parts.
Yeah.
And you sort of forget some of the weird datedness, and there's that weird, like, private detective shtick with his, like, buddy sidekick.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
that does drag it down, but I think, I mean, it's hard to do, like, and you can, unless Del Toro actually manages to do Mountains of Madness, I don't think we'll see something that's, like, start to finish cosmic horror. I mean, I don't know how you can keep that up for an entire movie.
Sure.
The jury's still out whether he would succeed in that being the thing that Mountains of Madness actually conveys, you know?
Yeah.
I suspect there's going to be a lot of Nazis and Chagas and, you know, pulpy action, honestly.
Right.
From Del Toro, at least some of the things I've heard about the production, but suggest that. I'd also throw out, let's go ahead and throw out a couple other, you know, films that people need to be aware of. And I mean, obviously the HPLHS people have produced faithful adaptations of Lovecraft in the styles of old-timey movie making with Call of Cthulhu and The Whisper of Darkness.
Yeah.
Those are both very good, but I want to throw out Our Point.
Now, that's interesting. Yeah. I know you brought this up in our earlier conversation. I've seen Our Point, and I think it's a good horror movie, but I don't see the Lovecraft. I mean, it's been a couple of years since I've seen, more than a couple of years since I've seen it. What is the I know the premise being Korean soldiers in Vietnam.
Well, it's the poisoned. You know, Lovecraft occasionally does that poisoned place sort of thing.
Okay.
It's certainly implied in the film that while there were bad things that happened on this island, the place was anointedly bad to start with. Okay. Certainly, there are no answers given for what the problem is. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, certainly, Lovecraft is not. He's not necessarily all cosmic horror. I mean, that's what we really know him for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he talks about the weird tale. He talks about the need for the sense of the uncanny, that the world is out of place. Yeah. And I think Our Point does have some of that, you know.
At least as much as
The Objective. I mean, except The Objective, you know, sort of overtly.
But the ending, yeah, especially. But. I would, along that vein of the Poison Place kind of movies, there's another one, very recent one on Netflix called Resolution.
Nice one, yeah.
Yeah, and it's about a guy who goes up, he gets this weird cryptic video message from his friend, his old friend, who is a drug addict now. And he's up in the boonies, up in the foothills near an Indian reservation, and he's squatting in this just abandoned house. And the friend's like, fuck it, I'm going to help him get clean. I'm going to give him one last try. And so he goes up there, and it starts with him being handcuffing, like, pretty soon after handcuffing his friend. He's like, I'm going to give you a week. You're going to detox. And then if you still don't want to go to a rehab clinic, I'm going to leave. And so, like, but the place itself is just a tainted place, kind of like in Our Point. It's just wrong and weirdness. It kind of is more Unknown Armies than Call of Cthulhu, but you could certainly mine it for
kind of material. Would Pi fall into the Unknown Armies category?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's very, very Unknown Armies. Or Over the Edge,
The most Cthulhu-ish gaming moment in film, we all have to tip our hats to Alien Raiders.
Oh, yeah. Certainly the setup for that.
That one plays out like a fucking game. Like a con game, in fact.
Yeah.
It's actually in a movie that very much under the radar. Very, I think outside of the the HPL Film Festival. I haven't heard of it at all, and I don't, it's on Amazon Instant Video. It's not on Netflix. But the premise is that there's a group of armed guys who rush into this supermarket, and they, at first it looks like a robbery, but then they start testing the people there, and they chain everybody up there, and you're kind of seeing that. Well, what are they really after? And of course, Alien is in the title.
A lot of this conversation happened off screen before they bust in.
Yeah.
It's kind of good because it doesn't like treat the audience like an idiot, but it's kind of like I'd love to see more of that setting or universe, because there's a lot more there. It's one of those rare movies that there's more behind the scenes than what you actually see, and you kind of want it. You're left wanting more. Whereas most movies, you kind of feel like that's all there is. It's just very shallow. And
I think we're all willing to give Alien Raiders at least an 8 or a 9, with the only minuses being that they didn't have the budget to do the monster as well as they hoped.
Yeah, the monster is kind of
but the ambition and the intelligence behind that and the acting.
Yeah.
Was actually extremely good. It absolutely plays out like a, you know, like the end of a Call of Cthulhu, you know, campaign. This is it.
Fuck it, we're just gonna go in there with guns blazing.
Yeah, we're ending this tonight. You know,
I'm on my third character. I don't care. I maxed out all the gun skills.
Meanwhile, the thing that looks like the start of a Call of Cthulhu campaign would be the pilot for Rough Magic, which you can see if you pick up the H.P. Lovecraft Collection Volume 2. It has alternatively been called Rough Magic and sometimes called Dreams of Cthulhu. That's absolutely one of the... It was a BBC miniseries. The whole miniseries was going to be government agents from a disbanded agency fighting the mythos. It was going to be Delta Green, the series. And they got one pilot and it died. It never went anywhere.
But it's really cool. It's got the fellow who played Avon in Blake 7, if anybody's a Blake 7 fan.
Yeah.
I don't remember his name. But you can pick that up on Arkham Bazaar. We still have a few left. It is quickly going out of print, though. That's... Volume 2 of the H.P. Lovecraft Collection.
Once upon a time, these were available on Netflix, but I don't know if they're available now.
Not anymore, no.
Dreams of Cthulhu is, or Rough Magic, whichever title it goes under, is absolutely everything you wanted from a, you know, TV series about people fighting the mythos. And sadly, we're not going to get, because it didn't get any further along than that.
That DVD also has a nice adaptation of The Terrible Old Man on it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Is that
the one also with Cool Air, or is not?
No. That's Cool Air's issue 1. But, yeah, it's Bob Fugger's Cool Air. Plus, we blow up some Nazis.
Well, yeah, that's...
I forget that Christian Matsky's experiment...
Stop digging, you've hit gold.
Experiment 17 and Experiment 18 are on that, so they're quite good.
That's what Volume 2 has always been. There were 5 volumes... currently, volumes 3, 4, and 5 are completely sold out and out of print. But volume 2 was always my favorite. I mean, between Rough Magic, The Terrible Old Man, and Christian Matsky's Nazis reading the Necronomicon.
Not to their benefit.
Yeah. Never.
You know, actually, I'd like to see a movie where the people read the Necronomicon to their benefit.
Define benefit.
Right. Well, that's the twist. You know, it could be a show.
You're gonna live forever and dwell in, you know, wonder and splendor forever. You know,
yeah.
Says Olmsted at the bottom of, you know, at the end of Shadow of Rinsmouth.
We do have happy endings after all.
Yeah. He's reunited with his cousin. It's going to be great.
Well, we ought to kind of wrap things up here because it's getting kind of late in the day.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, and we should get going because we're so close to the festival. We're doing a volunteer meeting, and then we're having a special screening event for backers only. Folks that back Kickstarter, so we're doing
that. I'm jealous.
We're doing a thing at the Lovecraft Bar here in Portland.
Oh, yes.
And we had a Lovecraft bar?
They have a Lovecraft bar.
I'll have to start thinking about moving there, man.
Although I will admit, the venue, the Lovecraft bar, has a wildly changing patronage. Because I've been in there where it's all, you know, looking quite gothy and, you know, tattooed and covered in face shrapnel. And I just remember that one night we wandered in there for a drink when I was in port, and for some reason it had been taken over by transvestites. Do you remember that night we were wandering? It's like, there seemed to be a lot of guys in skirts. Okay.
Huh. Maybe I didn't notice.
Well, it's just that's a good sign, because that means Lovecraft is reaching a larger and larger audience now. So, you know,
or at least that bar is.
Yeah.
Dubstep.
Yeah.
That really, well, it is. It's a nightclub, so they have different nights. You know, sometimes it's an 80s night and things like that. As well as being like gothic or horror themed, and they do like Batcave nights where it's all like, you know, gothic rock.
That's sort of what I suspect, is that we turned up on, you know, whatever genderbender evening was going on. And then
there are a couple times when the roller derby has taken over the bar for a little while.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
Do they keep the skates for some
of them did, yeah.
Lovecraft, disco themed Lovecraft bar night.
Oh, we
discotheque of the Dam.
Before we go, speaking of Lovecraftian adaptations, and now that we're talking about disco and musical genres,
uh-huh.
Have you guys heard the Dreams in the Witch House rock opera?
No.
I'm afraid my last contact with opera was, what was it, the Music of Erica Zahn.
Oh, yeah, but that was opera. This is rock opera.
Oh, different. Okay.
So this is it's by one of the guys, formerly of the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. Well, he still works with them, but he's got a day job now. But Mike Gallagher, he was actually in the Call of Cthulhu movie. He was one of the sailors, you know, with the white outfit and the sailor hat and everything. And turns out that he's quite an accomplished performer on his own, and he's even gone so far as to sing the national anthem for Padres games down in San Diego. And he got together a bunch of musician friends, including Doug Blair from Wasp, Bruce Kulick from Kiss, Chris Laney from, I think his band is Chris Laney, but he's out of Sweden.
Anders Fransson.
Anders Fransson, and like at least one of the guys from the band Therion. I don't know if you've heard of them. Therion does some great, nice sort of Lovecraftian operatic metal, but the Dreams in the Witch House is a great, very accomplished, serious, it sounds funny because it's got the word rock opera attached to it,
mm-hmm.
but it's a serious adaptation of Lovecraft's story Dreams in the Witch House that actually has great character development and deals with the primary elements of the Lovecraft story in a very intelligent and frightening way, but then also develops like a little more of the characters of Keziah Mason and Gilman and Elwood, and it's really a wonderful piece of art if you can get past the moniker that it's a rock opera, because that just makes it sound cheesy. It's not cheesy. And we're gonna have a performance at the film festival. At the Lucan. So if you guys, for those of you that come out to that, you get to see some selections performed by Mike and Elaine Cashin, which is the witch, and Doug Blair from Wasp is coming out also.
Man,
that's great.
So if you haven't heard that, that's as good as a film adaptation of Dreams of the Witch House. It's really worth owning and listening to.
All right. Well, Brian and Gwen, thank you very much for spending the afternoon with us.
Thanks for having us.
Anytime.
You bet. Best of luck with the festival. You guys have a great... It sounds like a really, really fun time coming up.
Yeah. I'll have to go next year.
Yes, you have to.
Well, you know, next year is the 20th
You've always been here. The what?
Next year is the 20th anniversary.
Oh, well then.
So we're already planning a lot of really special stuff to commemorate it.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. Like a human sacrifice, and it's going to be great.
Oh, yeah. It'll be great.
Come on out, Ross.
Bring the kids.
All right. Well, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having us.
We'll see you guys soon.
midgets in moots. The others are there, step and shoot the hair, be fouillet, yeah. The others are there. Hello, you, hello, Raku. Do you hear me with them kazoots in the boots? Neps
and the two. And before we leave, even though Brian and Gwyn have left, we still have a bit of news and some announcements to get through. Shane, I know you, of course, have some great news with the Tales from Failed Anatomies, the ongoing Kickstarter right now for Delta Green new fiction anthology.
Yeah. It's been super cool. It's got another week or so at this point, and then but it started off as a fundraiser for a collection by Dennis Detwiller, who of course is one of the creators of Delta Green, and of his short stories, and it hit its initial goal within about 12 hours. So since then we've been adding more and more stories as stretch goals, and at this point we've gotten enough of them generated and funded just from the Kickstarter program to publish Failed Anatomies Volume 2, which will be an anthology with a couple of stories by Dennis and then stories by tons of other people, including Scott and me and Ken Height and Cody Goodfellow and lots of other writers. It's going to be, it's been very, very cool to see it evolve.
And I know a lot of them have been backing for the Delta Green reward, the Alpha playtesting, which we'll get to in a little bit. Mm-hmm. And
audio things too. The guys at the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast that I've been a huge fan of since the beginning.
Yeah.
They're doing readings of a bunch of Dennis's stories that we've been doing as stretch goals as well. So they're putting those together, and if you go to the Kickstarter page, you can actually hear them doing a clip from one of his stories as the narration on the video.
Nice.
There. And it's very, very cool. So yeah, that's been great.
Yeah. And of course, I guess we should talk about the Unspeakable Oath, since I think that's connected to this podcast for some reason. Correct me if I'm wrong, but
well, they have in common that neither one of them comes out anywhere near as frequently as I want them to.
All right. So, what's the news with the Unspeakable Oath right now?
Well, we've got the sort of the scenario that's going to be one of the biggest single piece of the next issue of the Oath 24, we're about to send into playtesting now, and that'll be fun. It's a modern day haunted house adventure by Greg Stolze, and it's kind of very creepy and as a haunted house scenario, it's also very kind of sandboxy. He puts in a lot of ingredients and elements that you can kind of bring together either with the given suggested narrative or that you can kind of spin off long term if you want to have a more of a slow burn haunted house campaign or setting. So it's very neat. So we're going to be doing playtesting on that imminently, and then and John Scott Tynes and Dan Harms and I have been going through manuscripts and going through the submissions and pulling it together. So we'll have the new issue out, barring any major hiccups, we'll have the new issue out in May, and I'm going to be working immediately on putting issue 25 together, the following issue, so we can get that one out in a timely manner and doesn't get totally derailed. So I'm looking forward to that, and it's taken a while to get 24 together, but it's gonna be cool. And we've got a painting that Todd Shearer did that's really nice. That's based on The White Ship, the Lovecraft story that I've already had filed away to be the cover for it. So it's gonna be very pretty.
I'm looking forward to it. But of course, there's also leading into the big work, which is Delta Green right now. Everybody's eager about that. And as I mentioned, one of the rewards from Tales from Failed Anatomy is getting in on the Alpha team of playtesters.
Right.
So the rules are, I guess, Scott, you can chime in too. What is the current status of Delta Green? And what is there going to be a Ukrainian supplement coming up?
I'm really hoping that Vladimir doesn't do anything to make me rewrite the fucking Russian material. we had already made the decision that the Russian material, you know, was going to go from, in the 90s, you know, there was sort of this idea that the Russians, you know, in their pathetic state of collapse could maybe be our friends. But that's changed.
Yeah.
Because the Russians do not want your pity, they want your fear. Mm-hmm. And clearly, the, you know, what could have been your allies over at GRUSV8 in the 90s are clearly going to be the opposition in the 2010s and the teens. It's going to be a different face for the Russians. Fortunately, we'd already decided on that even before this particular, you know, before Vladimir Putin decided to torture the world's journalists with their horrible hotels in Sochi and commit atrocities upon the press corps and then, you know, take a punch at the Ukrainians. We'd already decided they were going to be not the organization everyone remembers from, you know, Countdown. Mm-hmm. So that's, unless, you know, he screws up so badly this year that Pussy Riot is in the Kremlin. I don't think we're going to have to change too much.
If changing directions requires, either requires Vladimir Putin to lose power or suddenly develop a debilitating conscience, I think you're safe.
Yeah. I don't think any of those things are happening anytime soon.
I don't say if they did, I'd lose sand. Like, I would be a sand chip right. Me, like... Talk about cosmic horror. Like, he developed empathy? What is going on? What insect burrowed into his brain?
Yeah, well, anyways, once again, trying to stay ahead of the events. Everyone knows what they're writing. They're just having to write it. We've made all the decisions as far as an editorial sort of stuff a while back, and we're just slogging through it right now, and hopefully everything's going to be done by the end. My writing will be turned in by the end of this month, end of March.
Is it mechanics or setting?
No, I'm only doing setting. I am nowhere near the mechanics on this.
All right. Yeah, and the mechanics were
done last year.
Yeah. So Greg and I did sort of the first pass at the rules, and then Dennis took them over and went after them with a meat cleaver to hone things down. And really sharpen it and refine it.
Dennis and I sat down in the College Inn pub a couple of weeks back and hammered out a couple of things as far as setting. I will admit I hadn't quite worked out, you know, what we were doing with you know, some of our old favorites like the Fate, but that question has now finally been settled. And again, it's you know, the whole theme of Delta Green this time out is, be careful what you wish for. I mean, Delta Green is surrounded by great victories in the new era, having vanquished all their foes from Delta Green and Delta Green Countdown, and it avails them nothing. I mean, it didn't help. If anything, it made things worse. Victories, certain victories have actually made the situation worse.
So, same shit, different day.
Yeah, well, I mean, Scott and I, this is a few years ago now, we had some really long conversations about the direction of things and sort of the implications of Forrest James, for instance, of key figures in Delta Green gaining significant power over what had been the Majestic 12 organization, you know, which was this kind of big, massive, secret, kind of deep state organization of projects and Defense Department projects and sub projects that were kind of ruled with an iron fist by this steering committee, which itself was ruled with an iron fist by one or two key leaders of the steering committee. And so that kind of set the stage for somebody from Delta Green to come in and supplant the Iron Fist rulers, but at the same time, that upset the whole apple cart because, you know, you've got you've got people that are now kind of trying to assert that control who don't have the experience behind them to know how to handle it, or the political savvy, or even necessarily the ruthlessness that the prior movers and shakers had. And so
what they did to Majestic 12 was a lot like hitting, you know, when you take your bedroom slipper and you hit that spider that's got all the babies on its back. Oh, look, we won. Oops.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess we're going to have to move out of the house and burn our beds because there's a million baby spiders in it. You know? A lot of it went that way. And if it didn't go that way, it went all Wolfram and Hart.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the mythos stuff from the previous books, you know, we've tried to sort of describe situations where the players, you know, what's it look like when the players beat the Karatekia? What's it look like when the players beat Cult of Transcendence? What's it like when the players beat,
Tiger Transit?
Tiger Transit, you know, and the result is it's not any better.
Yeah.
The eternal game of mythos whack-a-mole is not going to provide. What does Rustin Cole say about resolution?
Right. Nothing ever ends.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, one question that's sort of come up to me is, have you worked anything on that, the Haster mythos or Carcosa? I mean, the chapter in Countdown was very influential to me, as I've mentioned before in the podcast. But is there any new material about Night Floors or anything like that? Or is that for a future supplement? Or is that kind of...
I know Shane and I have had conversations where we were talking about that one of the things we want to press on players is the idea that the mythos is not necessarily something you can fix with a fuel air bomb. And when it comes to, and I don't just mean because you can't blow it up, you know, maybe you can blow it up, but the problem is that this access to the mythos uses a kind of technology that is impossible to root out of human civilization. It is perhaps the first technology of all human civilization. It's the root technology of so-called, you know, known history. It's text,
yeah,
right? It's words. It's writing. It's the ability to communicate knowledge, and the mythos travels in that technology, and it is ported directly into your brain through scribbles in clay or on paper, and the King in Yellow certainly has that aspect. As one of those mental plutoniums, I think is what John called it. John Tynes called it mental plutonium, I think. And so we've had conversations about various. One of the things we want to sort of emphasize is the idea that, you know, you don't need a cult. You just need some knowledge that's floating around, and various people pick it up and think, you know, wow, this is shiny. I should probably try and say this out loud. And trying to tamp that down is incredibly difficult. So the King in Yellow is one of the great exemplars of that. But I don't know I don't remember, Shane, because I'm not writing it. Do we have anything that's specific
we're not developing a we're not really developing a centralized Carcosa mythos cult or anything like that. I mean, it's getting a place in the GM's book to talk about that mythology and ways in which you can work that into the campaign and the different things that it can represent in a Delta Green campaign. But there's not going to be sort of a King in Yellow organization like there is for the deep ones, you know, that can be represented with Black Cod Island or the insects from Shigai, you know, with Pisces, right? Because to me, at least from my perspective, that kind of defeats the whole point of it. You know, I mean, the whole point of of The King in Yellow and Carcosa, to me, has always felt like it's kind of the closest that human beings can get to internalizing and comprehending the nature of reality, you know, and which is to say that we're not built for it, and that way lies insanity and everything kind of falling apart in a very rapid way, and the sort of madness and futility of inevitability, and all of that to me kind of speaks against a lot of really really organized presentation, as much as things that kind of crop in out of nowhere if you want to build that into your campaign.
We built in the right. Secret Senate into the Cult of Transcendence, but even those guys, it didn't really matter if you showed up with a syringe full of potassium and whacked the Carcosa, the poet laureate of Carcosa, mm-hmm. With a massive heart attack. It's too late. He already wrote the stuff. It's on the internet. Mm-hmm. It's being traded around. It's out. You can't purge it from the system.
Right. And so you're going to certainly have people that are fanatics for Carcosa and for the play, The King in Yellow, in the setting, just as you have those of us who are fanatics for it for the fictional version of it in real life.
Oh, of course, it's fictional.
I said it's fictional.
Right.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
And but so anyway, that seems to me that the atmosphere seems a little more appropriate when it's something like that, when it's this sort of you're encountering something that's inherently that disorganized as opposed to a central threat which you can confront in some way.
There will be no Hierophant in Yellow.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. I just asked because, again, we were talking about True Detective, so...
Right, yeah.
In other news, you've been running, speaking of hopeless situations, you've been running Future Perfect online. Is that correct?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's been fun. I've set that up with... Mike Davis at the Lovecraft e-zine, lovecraftzine.com, and I actually have a page where I'm curating all the information and videos and links and everything at deltagreen.com as well. But it's been fun. Yeah, I'm running it as a live video chat game, and then it's being streamed live on YouTube, and then the videos are being, I guess, archiving them on YouTube as well.
Through Google Hangouts.
Right, through Google Hangouts, yeah. So you can actually watch it, or you can, I guess you're watching it at Google Hangouts, and then it's archived at YouTube. But so, so you can actually, you can watch each episode live, and Lovecraft's e-zine has a message board at Facebook, a message board page at Facebook for discussion and Q&A and questions. And so people that are watching it, pipe in with jokes or suggestions or things like that. And then sometimes, Mike Davis, who runs the site, usually sits in on the games. And so he might pop in with a question or an out-of-character suggestion for the players from the message boards or something like that. So it's kind of interactive. And it's been very fun, the group.
So is the message board like a Greek chorus?
Yeah.
or is it like hecklers from the audience like, no, don't read that?
Oh. Yeah, it's totally both. Okay. Yeah. It's the Greek chorus.
Well, you know what the logical next step is.
Spending half their time heckling and making fun of you. Yeah.
What is the logical next step, sir?
Twitch plays Delta Green, like that would be the which is a have you heard of Twitch plays Pokemon?
No, I have not.
Okay, that. So Twitch.tv is a streaming site where people can stream themselves playing video games, and so people have been watching, people play various video games live, and you can watch like past performances on there. But somebody set up a script to where they took an old first generation Pokemon game Black and White Game Boy. Put it on his computer with an emulator, then set up a script so that anybody in the chat room watching that stream could type in a command and it would be entered into the game. So you type in up and the button up on the emulator is command, so the character in Pokemon goes up. And so it started with a small group of people kind of cooperatively playing the game, but then it grew to an absolutely absurd size of like tens of thousands of people all trying to play the same video game at once.
Welcome to the internet.
Yeah. It really is the distilled internet. And what's the Delta Green connection is that people started forming like religions or sort of cults based on specific items in the game because of the way it was very easy for them to accidentally like try to use an item called the Helix Fossil, which is a fossil of a fossilized Pokemon. And they're like, oh, it isn't the time to use that. So they'd use it dozens of times. Oh, it isn't time to use it. Consult the Helix Fossil. Oh, praise the Helix Fossil. And like they created religious fan art, like in the style of Egyptian hieroglyphics.
Of course.
And in a game that takes about 30 to 40 hours to beat at most, it took them 16 full days to finally beat it. They just beat it like yesterday. Yeah. But it's fascinating to watch from a point of view as the tens of thousands of people, millions watched at one point or another, of them trying to beat this game from 1996. And some people were trying to deliberately wreck the game. People were like, let's release all the Pokemon. Let's delete all our Pokemon. No, let's do this. Let's do that. And
wow.
So clearly the next step is we have to figure out a way to do tabletop RPGs with a streaming audience telling the players what to do. Mm-hmm. Not that we, you know, kill the hostage, shoot the hostage, read the book, read all the books, set the book on fire, set yourself on fire, you know, like
that kind of. I can kind of envision a way to do that to start with maybe a single player and just tell the player, yeah, the player that, okay, your character is getting the signals from 10,000 alien intelligence simultaneously, and what you have to do what they say on this crazy board.
Yeah, I think that would be clearly it's the next step. So I'll send you links after that because the religious fan art has to be seen to be believed. Yeah. But. In other news, before we go, I just want to mention a couple things that we're doing over at RPPR, Role Playing Public Radio. First off, we actually are playing The Sense of the Sleight of Hand Man, and I haven't posted any of the episodes yet, but I will, in the next few months, start posting them. We're three sessions into the campaign. We played the first two sessions, and then I had a long break because I went on vacation to China, and I've just come back. I just ran the third session. Aaron's only almost died once. So the mm-hmm. players have almost died several times though, but mm-hmm. I'm making some changes to the campaign, but it's been very fun. And,
it's definitely built to be customizable. I mean, when I ran it for several sessions for my friends locally. And I
I changed the pirate encounter. Like they mm-hmm. went over the ocean, so I changed that pretty heavily. And instead of them having been captured by pirates, I had them stumble upon a ship that had been hit by pirates, and they decided mm-hmm. they had a vision that they needed to go and save the person there. And so they try to sneak into the pirate lair, and bad things happen as they are wont to do in the Dreamlands. And one of the players is still convinced that he's just dreaming. Like, oh no, I wonder what the symbolism of the pirates means in my right. in my head. What would Young say about this? And it's been quite fun.
How have the players taken to it?
They've gotten into it. They've gotten into it pretty well. They're having a good time. They certainly are. A lot of them are spending their time trying to raise their, you know, archaic weapon skills up.
Right.
because they made characters that they actually made good characters in the sense that they were like people from the 1920s, so they didn't really have like maxed out, you know, spear and broadsword skills.
Put points into battle axe. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shockingly.
Yeah. I will have to put in some absurd way for one of the characters is obsessed, like, is playing a gangster obsessed with his Thompson submachine gun who he calls Lucille. Mm-hmm. So I'll have to put in a way that he can find Lucille in the Dreamlands. But of
clearly
course,
it'll yeah. be a, it'll be one of those belt fed crossbows we've heard so much about.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, he has 75% submachine guns. I don't want him to waste that skill.
Too bad for him, as far as I'm concerned. That's the problem with the scenario or with any trip to the Dreamlands. You're not equipped.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, and that's part of it is, you know, you're if you're playing right. characters who are sort of from the waking world dragged in there.
Yeah.
Then, yeah. I mean, one. Yeah. I when I was running it, I decided to. What did I do? I think first and foremost, I basically gave. I made 25% be the baseline for all of the archaic weapons. So even the ones that in official Call of Cthulhu were listed at like 10% base skill, I just said you could have it at 25 base. And then you could also, I mean, you could also do things like have that character, for example, through a process of directed dreaming, sort of seize on to some other weapon that's acceptable to the Dreamlands or to whatever kind of hive mind makes the rules for the Dreamlands, replace the submachine gun that he's so in love with. So his, you know, while he's in the Dreamlands, his massive 75% god of submachine guns, right, might turn into he's the god, you know, he's the god of swinging a saber or shooting an arquebus or something, right?
Yeah, it's definitely, yeah, I've definitely been making some changes. I've been definitely letting players experiment more. Like, one thing I've always wanted to do in a Call of Cthulhu game is let players play around, quote unquote, with magic some more and let them explore. So I'm letting them have easier access to spells and tomes and that kind of thing. Not just freely, like there are always costs for it, but like I want them to, like, you know, have that more game. Like, how much sand do I want to give up so I can get past this encounter? You know, that kind of.
I think that's key. I mean, in the Dreamlands, you've got a lot of opportunity to do that, but it's crucial to always have it come back to something sinister, to sort of these unseen forces that are moving just behind the under the surface, that are kind of driving the characters in unpleasant and unwholesome ways.
But we've had a lot of fun with it, and so I plan to run the entire campaign. Until they get to the end, or there's a total party kill, so we'll see which one they wind up with.
If you get really nervous, then just start having them take their damage to sanity for a while instead of hit points.
Oh, that's a good idea. I should do that next time. And then the other thing we're doing that's sort of horror, definitely horror related, is, although not specifically Mythos, is Caleb, who he has done a lot of Cthulhu Mythos stuff with through his No Security Kickstarter and his systemless scenarios, which are on DriveThruRPG. But he's creating a new game called Red Markets, which is a post-apocalyptic zombie economics role-playing game. And what the premise is that the players... west of the Mississippi is zombie land, and east of the Mississippi is like, everything's terrible, dystopia, but like, no zombies, so hooray for that. And so the
it's amazing what you'll put up with not to have zombies.
Exactly. And so the players are takers, which are basically kind of like Shadowrunners, only poorer and with less gear. And no, in fact, they're not really like Shadowrunners at all, but they go over the wire to scavenge and run missions to make money, so they can, like, the goal of the game is for your characters to stop being a player character, like, so you can retire and, like, not have to risk your life against terrible, you know, zombies. And he's put in a lot of economic mechanics in there, like in terms of bidding for jobs, negotiating with it, ways to loot everything, your equipment. You have to pay maintenance for your equipment. There's and like the currency in the game are driver's licenses, because the way the government works is like, if you can turn in someone's ID and say, see, this person's dead, then the government says, oh, well, we can legally seize their assets now because they're dead. And so they're, which is called bounty. So you pick up bounty by picking up driver IDs. And so we've run two sessions of the alpha playtest so far. We'll have a podcast. We're doing a series of podcasts called Game Designers Workshop, where Caleb and I are talking through his experience creating a role-playing game from scratch. He's creating his own system for it. He's not using an existing game system for it. So it's interesting to go through the alpha playtest of a role-playing game from scratch and to give feedback on, like, oh, this works, this doesn't work. The critical failure, critical hit mechanic is a little off. Mechanically, it should be 5% right now, but now I've rolled like 8 critical failures in one game, so Caleb's rethinking that a little bit, I think. I don't know. It's still an alpha, so it's. But we'll have another podcast about the playtesting pretty soon, as soon as the weather, you know, calms down here. We're getting another snowstorm here in Missouri, and so that's something to look forward to. And we have several already talking about the creation, the process of Red Markets. The creation of it. So, yeah.
And Caleb's also working on a campaign for us, for Arc Dream, for our supervillain role playing game, Better Angels. Right? He's been working on a campaign, No Soul Left Behind, set in a public charter
school. And the playtest of that is actually on RPPR Actual Play. I just posted the fifth session of that.
Awesome!
Excellent.
I need to start listening to those. I didn't know those were online already. That's great. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we're getting a ton of comments. People really enjoy it. So, but yeah, the supervillain, the evil in that game is all player caused. Like, we're just terrible supervillains. And terrible not
is when is it not player caused? Right. I've run into far more horrible things created by my players.
Uh-huh. Just to give you an idea, like my character, I played in the game, and my character's main superpower was transmutation. I could turn things into other things. And so we're trying to raise money, we're trying to get money as supervillains to protect the high school that we're all connected to. Like, they're all we're all teachers or parents. So we all were, it's a noble goal. It's
saved. Sure.
We must help these kids. Uh-huh. Is the motto of the school. So we're in St. Louis. So we figure, we can hold the Budweiser Brewery or the Anheuser-Busch Brewery hostage. We can get a ransom for it. And so we take it over. We take everyone hostage. And as a part of, like, oh, there's a bunch of security guards in there, and they have guns. What do I know? I know. I'll turn that guy's hand into something glowy, and they'll all get scared. I turn his hand into uranium, and so I do that. He runs off screaming. Everyone puts their plutonium. And so, long story short, I irradiated the brewery.
Yeah.
And
the only missiles. Thing that glowed that you could think of, huh?
My character is not a wise man.
Okay.
Like, he is not this, he is not very.
You couldn't have turned their handguns into Euros.
No. No. I could not. But I irradiated the brewery, and bad things happened.
Yeah,
but
I'm reminded of the story of the players who needed a human sacrifice to close the gate, so they ordered a pizza.
Wow, that's even worse. My character was being evil by accident. He didn't even really wasn't thinking about the radiation that much. But no, yeah, that's cold. So,
30 minutes or less, we're gonna have this game closed and save the world.
You know, and that's just that's just so cold, because you know that screws everything up for the next poor sap who's wanting to order a pizza, because now the delivery driver is nowhere near gonna show up on time.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, and after the gates closed, we can have 7 different pizzas just sitting, telling them to go to waste.
Exactly, the perfect crime.
Player characters are such assholes.
Well, you know, you say murder hobo like it's a bad thing. I don't know where, Ross, you picked that up, but
it was actually from 4chan.
Yeah.
They coined the term. They do a lot of horrible things, so they, of course, came up with Murder Hobo. And it really does really encapsulate the player character philosophy.
Yeah.
I think. But finally, in the last news, I think, Scott, do you want to give us an update on the Horrors of War?
Well, Horrors of War has to be mostly on hold until we're done with the Deltarune writing. I definitely had a window right after. I guess I had some of a window after Gen Con to get that Kickstarter launched, but the result would have been that I wouldn't have been able to work on it. I would have been able to run the Kickstarter, raise the money, and then I would have spent all this time working on Deltarune instead, right, which would not serve my public. So I just keep pushing the Kickstarter back until I'm done working with Shane on the Deltarune stuff, and I won't be done with it all through the summer. Once the majority of my writing is turned in the end of this month, I can go back and go to work on trying to get Horrors of War back up. And Horrors of War is our World War One scenario anthology and source book for sort of creating one-off scenarios that the players can have a reason why their character knows about the mythos is because they encountered the mythos while serving as soldiers, and it gives an opportunity for, you know, player groups to have a reason why a 1920s player group will have, you know, a guy who's a street urchin who knows the college professor because they were all in the same unit together, perhaps, you know, and it'll allow for characters from different social classes to be able to come together and have 1920s Call of Cthulhu games. Plus, it's all just cool one-offs of using the Great War as a background, and we've really just done had a great job finding all this stuff that's not trenches. Mm-hmm. Everyone thinks World War One is trenches, and granted, the Western Front is the deciding front of the entire war. And I can say that because the Germans won in the East; they completely beat Russia. Russia completely collapsed. They completely beat the Romanians. They won on all these other fronts.
Russia collapsed so hard it stopped being Russia.
Yeah. And even if the Brits had knocked out, Turkey, rolling up, Palestine and the Mesopotamia, it wouldn't have mattered. I mean, in the long run, it didn't matter to Germany. The deciding front is always the Western Front, trench warfare, Flanders, all that kind of stuff. But there's all these other amazing corners of the world, and in some ways, it almost feels like World War One gets into places that World War Two did not. South America, the Pacific, it gets into the Pacific Islands, I suppose,
African colonies.
Yeah. So one of the places that and one of the things I needed to do recently was come up with a scenario to run at the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival, and I think I finally found something. I've been trying for a long time to come up with an Italian front scenario, which is, it's all the horrible of all the other fronts, but with the added benefit that you can fall to your death. because it's literally trench warfare on the sides of mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And you're going to your, in the Western Front, you're going through these tunnels. They literally built these dugouts and tunnels so they could run entire divisions up to the front trenches, mm-hmm. and force cycle men through here undercover. Well, the Alps are like that. The Austro-Hungarians versus the Italians, with the Italians being the allied power in this thing. There's tunnels cut through mountainsides to move troops up to the front. There's precarious trenches blasted out of the sides of mountains using dynamite because you can't dig in granite. Let me see. How horrible is it? More people died on the Alpine front from avalanches than died from chemical warfare.
Jeez.
That's the first bad news. The second bad news is you hear about things like the first and second battles of the Somme in the first and second battle of Ypres in the Western Front, you know, thus implying that perhaps the front didn't move very far despite the, you know, gargantuan casualties. The Italians have the battles of the 1st through 11th battles of the Isonzo River. They had over 2 years, they fought, 2.5 years, they fought 11 battles over the same piece of real estate and did not move the front anywhere. I recently got a chance to watch an Italian war film called Many Wars Ago, which was made in the 60s, and it was about the Italian front. And it had every kind of terrible thing that happens in the Italian army. The players will be playing Italians, and being in the Italian army is actually worse than anywhere else in the war. Mm-hmm. It is worse than being in the Tsar's army. It is worse than being in the German army. A couple of things that stood out were a punishment detail where men were tied to stakes in front of their entrenchments so that if the Austrians wanted to shoot them, they could. The thing is that the Austrians are so tired of of the slaughter, they rarely ever shoot the guys who are tied up out front. Because they're just so sort of sick at heart at the slaughter. Mm-hmm. The other thing that was quite, sort of evocative was there's a scene in the movie where there's wounded soldiers who are going past an officer who's reviewing the circumstances of their wound. And if they can't justify their wound, they're arrested for self-inflicted and you go to the room to the left. That room eventually ends up in a courtyard with a firing squad.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Jeez.
So you're there with your shrapnel in your ass, and they're like, not good enough, get out, go to the left. Typical trick to try and make it look like you've shirking your duty. At the very beginning of the film, an Italian scout calls a halt to the arm, to the column's progress because there's a bunch of, Austrian machine guns with a crossfire in the road. They can march through it, but they'll be mowed down by Maxim guns. And when it is reported that the column is halted, the general's response to this is, who ordered that halt? That is counter to my orders. It's like, well, it was our scout. Well, take him out and shoot him for, disobeying my orders. But sir, we're about to walk through a crossfire of Maxim guns. Did I ask you that? No.
Right.
I told you, so it's just this, completely insane world that's even more maddening than many places. And the Italian front is, the other statistic I love was that the injuries from artillery, there were 70% more injuries from artillery in the Italian front because when a shell lands in Flanders, it blows all that Belgian clay up in the air. But when it lands in the Italian Alps, it blows apart granite and right. sends all these razor-sharp fragments of stone flying everywhere. And yeah, you're up at altitudes where it's, it's like when I wrote the Zeppelin scenario, the players have to deal with high-altitude sickness. So yes, you're frozen on a glacier with high-altitude sickness getting shelled. So it'll be awesome. I finally figured out what to do for that, and the scenario is going to be, I'm going to take it to GameStorm, which is a convention down in Portland, on the 20th through the 23rd. I'm going to inflict it on some players there. When I get it nice and when I work the kinks out, I'll be taking it to the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival and inflicting it on the people who signed up for that.
Do you think it'd be short enough to run at Gen Con this year?
I'm hoping that I could. Well, the last time I ran a scenario at the film festival, unfortunately, I ran an investigation, and the players just not have the time to get through an investigation. Yeah. Con games have to be survival horror.
Yeah.
And so,
well, I mean, they could be investigation if you really focus on making a very brief investigation.
Yeah,
if you've had it with that in mind, but like a standard investigation, no, yeah.
It has to be incredibly railroady and short.
Yeah.
But So instead, what we're going to do is a survival horror. And yes, I'll try and run it at Gen Con, you guys. If you are looking forward to be, if you're looking forward to hanging off the side of a mountain, and again, these the photographs.
I volunteer my character.
I found these amazing photographs online of the Dolomite Mountains, where some of this stuff took place, and the mountains look like frickin' Middle Earth. All right, they're just these insane needle-like sharp peaks that are just sticking out of the ground like a bunch of granite knives. It's just an incredibly inhospitable looking environment. And so I'm really looking forward to trying this out both at GameStorm and at the Film Festival. I will be running another game at Gen Con. Henry Lopez, I'm trying to remember Henry's this is terrible. I'm forgetting Henry's game company. They're doing some sort of a future Cthulhu game, a Cthulhu-like in a sort of, sort of a Traveler 2300 style.
Is it The Void?
I can't remember. I'm a douche. This makes me a bad writer because I can't even properly stump from my topic. But Henry's got me writing a game for a tournament at Gen Con. So... I will be cranking that out as well, but it as well is a survival horror scenario where everybody's wearing a red shirt at the beginning of the game and will be horribly folded, spindled, and mutilated by the scenario.
I think you're talking about The Void. That's the sort of Traveler in space, which I have a copy of, and it's. Pretty interesting. There's a. I might run the intro scenario that I have in the book, but I haven't. I've only read the core book, which doesn't really. Doesn't really go into the horror part of it. It mentions a few monsters and things like that, but they just kind of like, here's the technology, here are the governments, here's the other things. Also, space things of darkness, and that's it.
Okay.
So I have not. I don't know much about the actual Cthulhuan elements in it, so that means. I think that kind of covers the news. So this has been episode 10 of Unspeakable, talking about Cthulhu Mythos in the media, the movies and TV. I'm Ross Payton, and I've been producing, doing this with Scott Glancy and Shane Ivey. And this episode's music is Nyarlathotep by Darkest of the Hillside Thickets, courtesy Divine Industries, copyright 2014. Visit www.thickets.net. So say goodbye, gentlemen.
Goodbye, gentlemen.
Good night, everyone.
Is the goal here. So, all right. Is someone typing right now?
Yes.
Okay.
Damn it, Scott.
it's very prominent typing.
Scott's writing the Delta Green RPG as we
speak. As we speak, because we have a fucking deadline, people! Sit there, fucking write something!
All right. All right.
We can hear you not writing the Delta Green manuscript.
Oh my God!